today that the committee raises and wants responses to. Is that correct, EEG?
Chair, that's correct. And others are from the areas we were proposing. Yeah, based on the comments that we received.
Yes, thank you. So let's try to begin giving it over to you just on the issue of Treasury here yesterday and some of the issues that arose. I had endeavoured to get hold of the DDG, but had not been successful, but it could have been that he'd gone to a meeting at 2, you see. So I will, round about 4 o'clock, try and call him again, because I would certainly want the DDG of finance in this area to ensure that members who come from the official to represent Treasury have been fully briefed, because it was clear to me that there were certain areas of which the chief director and her colleagues were not fully briefed on, and that makes the world of difference in your work. So that you know, we are on top of it there, and we are proceeding. So over to you now, DDG.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to request my colleague, Dr. Ria Nyanin-Gavan, to come and present on the glosses, and she will take the committee through the different proposals or areas that we highlighted from yesterday, also from the discussion.
Yes. Just name
from the name
again.
It's Dr. Ria Nyanin-Gavan.
It's in human rights law, it's in family law, it's also in child law and international law.
And international.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Members. I need to apologize in advance. My voice is a bit squeaky, but I can assure you do want me to interfere with the presentation. I'm recovering from a terrible influenza. Okay. With regards to the clauses we are presenting to you, the better part of the content work was presented by Dr. Masoja. So what we are trying to do here is to bring the committee to maybe an appreciation of the proposals we have made as to how will it be like when it's fixed. Starting with the provision that looks at the definition on visual artistic work.
One moment. I need to ensure that everyone has got that, because as a start, I don't. No, that is... You see, we do have this one, which we have just gone through. We now need the copyright one. That's why it's not very healthy for the assistant not to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. So the revised provision, basically they are an incorporation of the comments that we received from the public. We had to reconsider, obviously, comments that are also aligned with our policy position, and also bring about the clauses that I'm about to take the committee through. The definition there of visual artistic work, we are saying, as we propose, it means an original artistic work that was created for the purpose of being appreciated by the visual sense and includes a painting. It will include a sculpture, a drawing, an engraving, and a photograph. And it excludes artistic work such as industrial design, works of architecture, engineering drawings, digital or graphic design, fashion design, interior design, circuit layouts, commercial logos and icons for applications. What you will see in that provision is that we only excluded the word commercialize. If you look at the bottom, we have a policy recital that is backing their review. We are saying, unlike novelists and musicians, visual artists such as painters and sculptors, they do not directly attract the benefit of downstream payments when their work is actually exchanged in the market. And we say their work does not generate significant income from the reproduction and also communication rights that are provided to other creators under copyright law. So the artistic resale right, what it does, it seeks to correct these inequalities by ensuring that artists receive at least a small percentage of the sale price of the work when it is resold. I'm wondering if maybe honorable members are looking at it, and I should proceed to the next slide.
Unless they raise their hand, it means, for whatever the reason, they have fully assimilated the point and agree. Right, honorable William. Martin Munter on the charge.
Thank you, Chair. I just have one question. The ones that have been excluded in particular, like fashion design and interior, are they protected as well? If, for instance, if your fashion you design something, I don't know, you design some clothes, some sort of thing, and then it gets sold later on, you just get paid the first time, and then that's it, you don't get later on recognized for being the designer of that very nice hat, or whatever it was. That's what I'm asking. So the people that are excluded, are they protected elsewhere? That's what I want to know. Thank you.
Thank you. Just, is jewellery considered to be fashion design?
Okay. Maybe as...
Yes, do that.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe as a start, let me just open the floor to my colleagues to also make responses. But just to say, obviously there are other legal principles that are governing some of the aspects that I mentioned, which are specifically excluded for copyright purposes. But I'll open this floor to my colleagues to also make contributions.
May I ask from everyone if they would please give their name? You know, if it's the DDG, I know exactly who it is. But I think one should also draw members' attention to the fact that we're talking about visual artistic work rather than other forms of artistic work. All right, so if whoever wishes, as the doctor has opened the floor to
colleagues. Through you, DDG, to the rest of the colleagues.
Afternoon, Ms. Shendri Pariachi. So this, the nature of this right is for the fine arts, the paintings, etc., because of the heirs that have to benefit, and it's stemming from the EU and France. However, the other areas, such as jewellery, etc., are protected in terms of the Designs Act, because it's more of an industrial design application and is therefore excluded. Thank you.
And just while you're on the floor, all of you, the abbreviations to export births is never a problem. Never. But to politicians who expect it to be Jacks and Jills of everything, you know, abbreviations pose a problem. ARR, I take that possibly to mean artist resale rights. But I'm assuming that because it is not in brackets after the phrase. So I'm making an assumption.
I beg your pardon, Chairperson, to acronyze before we provide a full name. Indeed, ARR is Artistic Resale Royalty, Artistic Resale Rights, rather. And then the triple R is Resale Royalty Rights.
Have you been responded to, Honourable Williams?
Yes, Chairperson, I have, thank you.
Able to open up your fashion design shop. Right.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Honourable Members. Thank you, Dr. Masjocha. I'll proceed with the next slide, which looks at the royalties regarding literary or musical works. Maybe I should bring the committee to the members that yesterday we went through lots of slides that were giving flesh or at a background to Section 6A. So what I'm going to do again is to do a presentation as we have there of the clause. How will it be rather like when it is fixed? In the absence of an agreement to the contrary, no person may reproduce, publish the work, communicate or make the work available to the public by wire or wireless means as contemplated in Section 6A, B, C, D, E, A, and E, B, without payment of royalty to the author of the relevant copyright. The amount of any royalty contemplated in subsection 1 shall be determined by a written agreement between the author of the copyright and the publisher, or between their representative collective societies. So basically we are still retaining what we had previously, because the comments received from the public, they are quite happy with the session. The amendments actually follow later on as I go down. Where the author of the copyright and the publisher cannot agree on the royalty amount, the author of the copyright or the publisher may refer the matter to the copyright tribunal for an order determining the amount payable. That proposal is also straightforward. In the subsection 4, the agreement contemplated in subsection 2 shall include the following minimum requirements. This was actually backed properly yesterday by Dr. Masjocha to say these are simply minimum requirements. They are directive. Basically, we are saying but not limited to the following. The rights and obligations of the author and the publisher, the agreed amount of royalty payable, and a dispute resolution mechanism. So what we are trying to do there is to be cautious, just to stipulate what will be an entry into an agreement, but obviously we're giving the parties the latitude to can contract as they will.
Principle act as well as what we're doing here. You know, it is important, and that's why you've got to please keep the principle act with you as well. Everyone got that? Please. Right, okay. So, you know why I'm not surprised now I don't see a hand? Because yesterday, I mean, there's hardly any cool air in here with the discussion. Yes, so now no one has a question. Yes, Honourable Esterhazen?
Madam Chair, if I may ask, I own an advertising company. You include drawings, engravings and such But graphic designers, I have to employ graphic designers, and I do graphic design for a company, and I charge them for it, but it's excluded. But the graphic designs that we've done, which cost money to produce and to do, is excluded. The normal drawings and engravings and such is included. I really don't get.
DVG is not included in the graphic design field.
Do you want to come in here, or shall I get Dr. Nonyana Mukubani? I hear you, Honourable Member. We are talking about a specialized dispensation around this artistic resale royalty. It does not apply to all other forms of artistic, works around the art. So it talks, as Ms. Parayachi was saying, we are looking at fine art, sculptures, original work. So the areas that you've indicated, even in the provision, we are excluding them, like architectural work, we're excluding the drawings, we're looking at fine art, as in paintings and so on. So it's very specific, this nature of the artistic work.
Yes, I think Honourable Esther Hayton is preferable if you speak to the mic. Charlie.
Just to be clear, these are just definitions.
Yes.
You're just explaining the definitions, the rationale for the definitions.
The very first clause, yes, is on definitions, but it's on one definition, on visual artistic work, but on the second one, it's not on definitions.
The one we're dealing with right now, on page 3, is not a definition. Right. Yes, DVD.
I'm a little bit unclear in terms of the presentation. So what are you taking us through? You're saying here's the definition of visual artistic work for the purposes that it applies to clause one here, right? And then the purpose of taking us through slide 3 is what?
If I can come in. If I can come in, please. Yesterday I did a presentation and it was going through the advertised clauses and it was highlighting areas where changes were required. One of them was issues around the definition, how to simplify it, whether it was broad or narrow enough. There was an area around the issues around the percentages, the minimum contract. Then the proposal was that for literary work and audiovisual, the way that we have had them on the bill is a bit of a challenge. So, like for example, assignment is an issue. So we needed to come up with an alternative definition, taking into account the comments. So this clause that we are proposing is to the proposal to replace the existing Section 6A in the bill currently. So this is an alternative. So if you look at it, we have removed words like assignment,
yes.
And because there was a confusion whether you can assign and still retain a royalty, for example. And then another issue around it was on the cooling off period, to say cooling off period does not apply to the literary works. Hence, on the proposal, we have removed it. So this is more of what we presented yesterday, but now we are giving a more clarity in terms of the actual clauses that we are proposing. So this it will apply to 6A, and the same will apply to 8A, Section 8A that looks at audiovisual, because it also was drafted from the assignment perspective. And what we have done, because 9A, in the Section 9A is already clear, we are using that format that gives precedent to the contractual arrangements without making reference to assignments. So that's what we are doing. It's just to say this is what we are proposing in response to those clauses from yesterday. So we are linking both presentations.
And I think this is it. We're highlighting the issues raised yesterday. So if we could continue on that, because the issue around agreements and cooling off became very, very important yesterday. Do go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you. Maybe I should really thank you, Dr. Masoja, for noting that part on the cooling off period, because it was quite critical. Then I withdraw the hand that I had earlier on. I wanted to bring that to the fore.
And I assume that Section 6A should say royalties regarding literary and musical works, not all.
Definitely chapter 10, but we'll have to infer from the principal act whether it is all or end when it will be attended to.
Mr. Pecci, did you
want to comment
on that?
Thank you, Chair. I was just going to reiterate the very same point to say in the principal act is couched as all. Therefore, we maintain the very spirit.
Well, the spirit may well be there. As a kid van der Merwe, you know this issue of some of the principal acts misusing things like and in awe and in consultation, etc. Is this correct here? It's either literary or it's musical, or it's literary and or what? Just if you can advise us legally here.
If you read it like that, I understand why they have all, because if it talks about copyright, it talks that Section 6, for instance, mentions nature of copyright in literary or musical work. I think in this case, what we'll have to do is it will have to be determined by the content. If we distinguish between literary work, so the royalties in respect of literary work, and we make that different to the royalties of musical work, I think it should be all. But if they end up being the same, then I think it should be and.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Surely if you just put in at this stage and stroke all, it covers both.
You ended with such a flourish, I told you I shouldn't comment. Had to get handed over.
See, unfortunately, in drafting, or is the safer one if you want to have it mean both. Because or can mean and. But and should not mean all. So and means it must be both. And if it is or, it could mean either or both.
On the side of safety. I think that's the decision here. And if we can then move on. I'm sorry, DDG.
Thank you, Chair. Another area we could have noted here is around remuneration. Some of the comments that came back were suggesting that we need to not only look at royalty, but to also consider other remuneration. And we are saying that has got different interpretations, also from an employment perspective. And I would like Dr. Ria Mugabane to extend on that part about what are the implications of the remuneration usage word.
Thank you, Doc. In terms of remuneration, we felt that it's not actually within our mandate to even begin to define remuneration when we have the Labor Relations Act doing that. Remuneration is specifically for services that are rendered, and here we're talking about royalty and payments, not really remuneration.
Yes, that's interesting, isn't it? The way it has been separated, and now that you've explained that, I do understand the remuneration reference to the Labour Act. Yes. Are we all in agreement there? Let's check with the whip. Honourable Kadevi? Yeah, the Honourable Williams?
With regard to this, I'm a little bit concerned about the remuneration. What about actors? They get paid on the spot, if you know what I mean. They get paid with their job. You know, they don't get royalties, really. They're not writers or anything. So I'm just wondering if that's covered with the remuneration, or is that a different section that they would look at with that? I'm talking about actors here.
No, I hear what you're saying, and I'm wondering, are they singers or what? Because, and it's a question I would add here, does that not more of the actors fall or singers, it comes again under the protection of performance, is that correct? Yes, I have seen it. So I'm just asking for a clarification here. When you're saying royalties regarding literary or musical work, isn't that separate to the performance? That is the question I'm actually asking. Yes, Honourable Mantash?
Chair, I share your sentiments. What I was going to say is it not that actors will be covered under the performance bill?
Perhaps we need that clarity here before we even entertain remuneration and royalty.
I would request Shendri to come in, Chair, to address. Thank you. So this act does cover audiovisual works in Clause 8 that we will get to shortly. What we're trying to do, it is covered in both bills, so we want to plug it in first in the copyright because of our accession to the Beijing Treaty for audiovisual performers, and then we'll break down the economic rights in more detail in the performers' protection.
Having got that explanation, unless you wanted to add to it, Advocate Mandemura,
I would like to ask something. I would like to ask guidance from you. I will be presenting after this on submission. If I have any concerns about a proposed draft, should I raise my concerns with the committee now as we go slide by slide, or should I, when I present, at that stage go through all of the wording and raise my concerns? I just need guidance.
Yeah, you can see everyone was now. So it seems that as we're moving along, it's quite useful to get, as it were, the entire orchestra involved. So,
thank you, Chief. I'm just a bit concerned about using the wording of Section 9A. Section 9A deals with royalties that are being paid to a copyright owner. So it's a very different type of royalty that you're speaking about. It's a royalty that is currently in existence. Everyone knows what you're talking about. If you pay a royalty, you pay to the copyright owner. What Section 6A was trying to address is a situation where an author has assigned their work to another person who is now the copyright owner, and that copyright owner is getting royalties for the use of the work, but the author is not receiving anything. So it was a very different situation from Section 9A. And I understand that there was a problem with the word assignment, but we actually had to use that word because the Act does not talk about the sale of copyright. It was actually something that we figured out in one of the last meetings on this bill, because we were talking about the transfer of copyright, the sale of copyright, and then we were getting worried about this assignment of copyright and how does this fit into the picture. And then it was explained to us by CIPC that it was actually every single transfer of copyright is called assignment. So that is why we use the word assignment. So What I'm a bit worried about is what we are now doing with 6A is what we are saying is that in respect of literary and musical works, if I assign my copyright to whoever, a publisher, and I'm not sure if the word publisher applies to musical works as well, but now I assign my copyright, let's say literary work, the publisher is now going to use that work. What Section 6A in effect is now achieving is that whatever the publisher is doing with that work, I will get full royalties. So the publisher, as the creator, Because what Section 6A now in effect for me is doing is it is taking the right of the copyright owner away to get royalties. Because what we are saying is no one may, in absence of the agreement to the contrary, reproduce, publish the work, communicate, or make the work available. That includes the copyright owner who has that right in terms of the act, without payment of a royalty to the author. So if it is just the copyright owner that is now affected, that says what we wanted it to do, there must be some royalty that is paid to the author. But if the copyright owner allows someone, which is their right to do, to reproduce, publish the work, communicate, or make the work available, the normal situation is that they would be able to ask for a royalty on that. And we are now taking that away, because if you, in an act, say one thing and you don't say the other thing, then by implication you are saying the other thing is not possible. So I'm a bit worried about that.
Does everyone appreciate what is being said now? Because it's a very important point. So I want you to repeat that. And then if we can't reach some form of convergence, we may need to ask everyone sitting on my right to go back and review this. I'm also, Advocate Foller, you were sort of implicated there with Flip C in terms of the phrase assignment. And how do you understand that phrase assignment or that word? Mr. Pecci, now make use of all that information you learned for the exam.
Thank you, Chair. I think the last time we were engaging the committee, we explained that assignment is a transfer of copyright ownership. When you assign your copyright, you are transferring ownership of that copyright.
Honourable Williams?
Sorry, I just want some clarity on assignment of copyright. So in other words, you're saying you can sell your copyright, but you still haven't assigned it, so it's not the same. You actually, the assignment has to, for the transfer of that ownership, the assignment must take place. You can't sell it. Selling is not the same as assigning.
Oh, let's get that clarity.
The selling is exactly the same as assignment because you are left with nothing.
Just a minute. Mr. Pecci, when something is assigned, you mentioned here it becomes the transfer of ownership. Now, under the transfer of ownership, it means it doesn't have to go through SIPC. Or does it have to go through SIPC as soon as the transfer of ownership takes place?
It doesn't come to us because it's a contractual arrangement between the two parties.
Right.
But assignment must be in writing. That's what the Act says, for it to be valid.
And the reason I asked that question is, if it had to be registered, the transfer, then the sale of something, what does that amount to? All right, but we've just heard that the transfer of ownership, the assignment, does not go through SIPC. Right. Now we'll come to other clarifications. Honourable
Mantai. If that's the case, that it is a contractual arrangement, then it means our system must be educated on it. Because I think this is what is like robbing them of what is rightfully theirs. And they are not aware of it. If I get it clearly.
Right, so the concern there is also, is everyone aware of the implications of this? Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, I want to go back to what the advocate was saying, because that seems to be a little bit peculiar. If the owner of the copyright cannot make any money from the copyright, then surely the whole bill is now questionable because of this clause. Because that's what I got from what the advocate said. If the owner of the copyright's making money from the copyright is it seems from this clause, what I understand is that it's only the creator of the work that's going to benefit from this clause, and the owner of the copyright won't benefit. Is that what you're saying from this clause? That's exactly right. So if that's the case, then the whole bill falls apart on this clause.
I must say, I thought that our concern on one hand, well, one of the many concerns, was that the creators of certain artistic work, whatever, whether it's literary or musical, that currently many of them are not benefiting currently, and that we would then produce legislation which would enable the creator to get some benefit, notwithstanding that the creator then says, but I'm selling this to X. The creator nevertheless retains some benefit. Honorable Kacharya.
I think this clearly highlights the issue. That in our attempt to do what the Honorable Chair said, to say that we are trying to get the creator to get some onward benefit, we are subsuming the separate and discrete rights of individual contracts by going through this. So ordinarily, I would contract with the Honorable Williams as the publisher, and the Honorable Williams will say to me, you can get 15% for whatever it is. And I agree, and I sign on the bottom line, or I can get 100%, whatever we contract and agree, and we can get, as the Honorable Mansa said, someone in to educate people to say, please look carefully and here are the guidelines. You should actually ask for more, you can ask for less. But at the end of the day, we have a contract. X percent comes to me. Then the publisher sells it onward. And that is a contractual agreement with that person going on. Now, if you seek to take the third agreement and tie it to the first agreement, is what's tying up in knots here. Because if you say that this person can't, the originator cannot get anything, the next one in line cannot get anything, then as Honorable Williams says, the whole system falls out, and the industry, the onward multiplying effect of the industry seems to fail. So we're in tricky water.
Look, let's get down to basics. What was our intention? What do the legislature intend to achieve? What's the intention? We go back to the beginning, and that is, it was trying to address the creators of certain work, on the one hand, among many other things. Now, if that creator sells it to the publisher, which is her, a contract is entered into. The creator is told, you'll get 30%, I'll take 70%. Now the publisher gets an offer from another publisher to purchase that. But does that second publisher buy 70%, which is all that the ownership is of the publisher, how can that publisher get 100% when the original contract with the publisher is 30% to the creator, 70% to the publisher? That's all the publisher owns, is 70%, not 30. That's my own understanding. But I see both Honorable Mantash and Honorable Kacharya having a difference. Honorable Mantash, Honorable Kacharya. Honorable, my apologies, do you want to come in now, Honorable Yesterday?
Madam Chair, as I've missed a few meetings and a commitment, maybe this was I remember this was we had on state-owned or state-funded, we'd make it a permanent expropriation when the state funded something. So maybe this was discussed in my absence. But this exactly the same if there's contractual agreement, again in a creator for an advertising environment, if you write music or whatever, graphic designs, whatever, for a company. Now, does this completely fall away then? You got no right to whatever you created, even if this could become a major hit if it's by music. Thank you.
Yes, I think you're underlining a very important point, Honourable Yester Hayden. Honourable Mantash?
Chair, this makes me scared. Because I thought after revisiting this copyright bill, was trying to ensure that no creator is left empty-handed at the end of the day. And that's why I was saying, Chair, if this is what the clause means, then experts must advise us, because we wouldn't have to be party to anything that takes our people back to square one under a democratic government, because that's not our money.
Thank you very much, Honourable Charlie.
Seems to me, it's my understanding that the publisher purchases the rights from the creator for a consideration of X percent. The ownership of those rights is then vested with the publisher. The publisher then goes on to say, I now wish to on-sell those rights in some way, shape or form for some percentage, whole or half or quarter, to somebody else for the purposes of X, Y, or Z. And then those proceeds from that sale must accrue to the owner of the right, because it's the right that is being traded, not the creation. Now, that seems to me, as a layman, to be clear in my head. Perhaps the advocate can clarify for us.
And then, in the process of clarifying this, so the advocate Dandanova has wanted to come in for some time, if that is the case, then you have sold the right. What control or right or whatever do you have over the fact that perhaps now that I've got the right to your work, I'll put my own name on it? It's mine. And I don't like your name. I'll have my own name there. No, you've got the whole right to this now. You own it. I want to know exactly what this means.
Jay, if I may maybe just start first with the issue of assignment. Section 22 of the Act says, subject to the provisions of this section, copyright shall be transmissible as movable property by assignment, testamentary disposition, or operation of the law. So, assign, I think it confused us all, because in my mind, the word assign means something very different. It talks about rights and obligations, and you know, whether you delegate or assign or something. That's the image I've got of assignment. But the Act makes it very clear to us that the transfer of copyright in this Act is called assignment. So that is our starting point. The next thing that maybe just to quickly answer the questions before I go to the bill as it was at the time. What is Mrs. Fopp's question first, because I think that might have a very clear and easy answer. Even if you transfer the whole of your rights in the work to someone else who owns full copyright, and then what that copyright entails is described in the Act. So for every type of work, there's a different section that says copyright in this work allows you to do the following. What it does not do is it does not allow you to take the moral right of the author away in the work. So you can publish it, you can reproduce it, etc. But you cannot assume it's your own. There's a moral right, there's a separate clause that deals with that. Now, to come back to what Honourable Kacharya said, if we look at how our bill as advertised read. Clause 6A said, notwithstanding the assignment of the copyright, in other words, despite the fact that you have transferred your copyright in a literary or a musical work, the author, the creator of that literary or musical work, shall have the right to a percentage of any royalty received by the copyright owner. subject to the provisions of this Act, if that copyright owner executes or authorizes any of the acts in Section 6. Section 6 says, what does copyright in a literary or a musical work entitle you to be? Okay, so if the copyright owner exercises any of the rights that the Act allows the copyright owner to exercise, then the royalty that that copyright owner gets, a percentage of that royalty must go to the author of the work. And I actually think that was quite clear. It says that the copyright owner retains the rights that the Act gives that copyright owner in terms of Section 6 when it comes to literary or musical works, but we are creating an additional right for the author of the work. So, as our bill read, I actually don't think that there was much wrong with this. From the submissions, the concerns that I noted was we gave minimum contractual terms. And there was some concern about, are we not undermining contractual arrangements with this? So that I will speak to when I get to the submission. The other things that people said was, but should we not give guidance to the tribunal? Because if you can't agree on a percentage of this royalty to the author, the tribunal will determine it. So that was the other thing, guidance. The other question was, if the copyright owner now gets royalty, do we talk about license dues or do we talk about the profit? In other words, if he sells it on that profit, and I think it's quite clear, it is the royalty, so it will be the license used. And then there were questions about how would this type of work fit in. So I did not understand the submissions to actually have a problem with the way the clause was worded in the bill as advertised. So I would really suggest and recommend to the committee that we retain the wording of the bill as it is, because the comments, as I read them, did not attack the wording of the bill. They asked for more clarity to be given. Because, like I said, with the proposed wording, I think that we might be confusing royalty, as we understand it, as something that is paid to the copyright owner, with this new right that we want to create for an author. Thank you.
Let's just pause there a moment. Moment in time or the concerns that were raised in the submissions with respect to that, which we heard about earlier. Now, I mean, let's just get back to look at those concerns that were raised and then come back to exactly where we get, No, I want to listen to you when you speak. And I'm just trying to get this clarity. I want you to see what the submission was on this. I know what the submission is, but what the comments were on this. And what page is that on, Dr. Masorcha, of what you spoke to this morning? What page is it on? Same one. All right. So I want to just draw your attention to that, because the reason we're here where we are is due to the comments that were made. Now, if we look at the comments here and the concerns that were raised, you'll see on page 6, the very first one is assignment is not applicable to literary works. Really. Okay? And we go through this. Now, consequent upon these comments, the DTI made certain responses. And consequent to that, we then have now Dr. Nonyana Mokavani coming in with her comment in this regard. But sometimes when we get to the point where we are now, we should go back to what first caused all this. Why did this all come about? What was the source of the concern? And it's right here. So I would just like to draw members' attention to that page 6 before they comment on what we've just heard. Because as a result of that, I understand that the DTI decided we won't use the word assignment. And let me allow the DDG to rephrase some of the points she made yesterday.
Yesterday, flowing from this presentation, we did indicate we will reconsider the wording and come with some proposals. The issue of assignment was raised to say that it does not apply to the literary work. When we looked at the submissions, and we also looked at how we have interpreted these clauses at the beginning, we thought that it is we can consider what the stakeholders were saying, because the intention here is to ensure that there are royalties that are payable, is to redress and to ensure that contractual rights are taken into consideration. And when we looked at 9A in its spirit, 9A, we didn't even get, even though the areas were not advertised broadly around the royalties, we've never had any challenges with the way that it is drafted. So we saw it as a sub-example that we can use in this context. So, Chair, in our view, we may differ in terms of the wording of assignment with the advocate and how it can be drafted. But the main spirit of this is to ensure that contractual freedom is adhered to, royalties are payable, and the tribunal can be used as a mechanism to resolve issues between the contracting parties. And we think that the way we have proposed this clause is workable. And Chair, if it's okay, I would like to request my colleagues just to try to also support the motivation as to why we got here. We really did go back to the assignment debate. We went back to that to say, how then do we move, if we move from there, which motivation will work best? So if we can't necessarily come up with a conclusion, if we can agree on the principles, then we can reword it, maybe jointly or otherwise. But I think assignment should not necessarily feature in the spirit of the comments that we have received. But if it's okay, can you allow Nishendri and Gadi, even the drafter, to come in to speak to this?
No, we will get them to speak to it, but I also want to remind all of us that the seems to me very clear on its phrase, what assignment is, it's the transfer of ownership, full stop. Now, that is, you know, so we need now to try and take all the facts that we have in front of us into account, while keeping in mind what is the intention of the members here. All right. So, Honourable Kicharia, let's allow what the DG has requested, members from her team to come in.
Thank you, Chair. I think the police intervention stems from the fact that in the industry, we observed that authors do transfer their copyright to publishers. And then we wanted to come up with a right that will be perpetual for the author of literary work, even in instances where she or he has transferred his or her copyright to a publisher. So the wording, I think we can sit together and come up with a wording that reflects that policy intervention. Whether we use assignment or we use a transfer of copyright, it doesn't matter. As long as we can come up with an arrangement that can reflect a situation whereby an author has transferred wholly his or her copyright to a publisher. We want to allow the author to continue to benefit when that work is commercialized. I think that was the policy intervention that we wanted to make.
That's very clear. Who would you like to come in next?
Okay, we will need to converge on this. I'll ask Mr. Mwango to come in.
Let me assist you. Sometimes when we get to this point, there can be a reluctance to commit oneself to the mic, because whatever is said on the mic is recorded. Now, you know, there's a kind of reservation I see on the faces here. And let's not force the issue at this point. Let's allow you to engage with the group so that everyone's on the same page. And let me now allow the members who've been very patient to come in. Now, I'm going to start from my left to my right. And the only reason I am is because the Honourable Khadebi had his hand up for some time. So we'll say Honourable Khadebi, Honourable Mantash, Honourable Kacharya, Honourable Yester.
Chairperson, if I had the power, I would have said that the parties on the Arafat must go and sit down and consult with Arafat so that they come to some sort of a common ground. And what also worries me is that the presentation of the advocate is still not going to lash on the issues of the submission. Because if it is lashing there, I would have preferred a situation whereby she presents so that we can get the holistic picture before we start dealing with the proposed clauses. I think I would have done that if I had the power, but I'm not sure. I'm powerless.
Chairperson, I would align myself with my week. But in all what the parties are doing, they must come up with a proposal that will ensure that the author is not left empty-handed. We can't be a government that takes away from people. We must put into people's hands. That's our standpoint at the ANC.
Yes, Honourable Kacharya,
thank you, Chair. I understand that Mr. Pichet said the intention of what was sought to be done here. In order to give meaning to that intention, we need to address clearly assignment, because that's what's happening, assignment or whatever it is. Now, when we were addressing assignment a few little while ago here, some alarm bells rang in my head, because it made me question whether in addressing it in the manner that we are, is it perhaps fundamentally flawed in terms of the legality, practicality, and logic of the amendment which we seek to put in place to give meaning to the intent that you enunciated. Now, what are we doing? We are saying a creator, and yes, we all agree, needs to be advised, and templates put in place to make sure that they don't, that they're well looked after, so we tick that box, we're doing fine. That they then sell their assign, sell their rights, whatever the word is, to the publisher. Now the publisher then has a contract which says, in terms of these clauses, additional clauses, film, animation, other, you will get remunerated in this fashion to by this amount which you agreed to. Contractual, everyone's having been advised, your eyes are open, you sign the contract, you get what you got. The question is, going forward, to give intent to what you're doing, which I'm questioning, if that's fundamentally flawed in logic, is that can one kind of give purpose to kind of cover and give a contract in the future that's not envisioned, and that is. And then that that comes back to the creator, to the owner, for a royalty, for some royalty to accrue to them, which has not been created, which doesn't exist, which you are waiting. If it happens there, we don't know what it is. It seems to me that the law doesn't work like this, and never has, in my humble opinion. But we are trying to do something, and I think that's fundamentally flawed. And I put it to the expert here. I'm no expert. The advocate can give her opinion, but I really think you need to go back and think this one very carefully, because otherwise you may be in trouble.
Honourable
guest,
Hazen.
I don't care thank you. Maybe I'm didn't understand it well from that book it kind of matter. But it seems now that authors, copywriters, publishers, composers, once they've made agreements with whatever company, they will now need permission, and they will even have to pay a fee to use their own work that they've created. And if the bill is approved in this form, that will make it unconstitutional. That will open this bill to some legal entertainment.
Thank you very much, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm going to talk about this assignment of copyright, in particular contractual assignment of copyright. The concern I have is, it's all very well to say that, for instance, the people in this room have the capacity to make a contractual assignment if we ever created anything. But our people are not all literate, for instance. You could have a situation where people might not be literate, or very good musicians, whatever. Suddenly they don't earn any money, and then somebody walks in and buys their stuff for a very small amount of money, and then, you know, they get ripped off, basically. So I'd like to know, is it not possible to have sort of like a minimum author retained royalty, whereby you can only sell 90% of something, and the other 10% will always be paid to the author, something along those lines, so that they're guaranteed at least 10% always, you know, on royalties. Thank you.
Right. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to change text somewhat. What we were suggesting immediately after yourself, DDG, was that the advocate come in. But you did believe that, I think, and quite rightly, that you should continue to address the issues raised yesterday, which you were doing. But the fact that you are continuing to raise the issues raised yesterday is now proving to be a problem. I'm not sure why, but it is, and it could be because it was yesterday and you have not had the opportunity to fully engage with the entire team, you see, so that you're all on the same page. So what I'm going to ask is this. We're going to, for the moment, pause on Dr. Nonyane Mokabani's presentation. We're nowhere near finished, it's here. We're going to find ourselves coming back to this at the next meeting. But we're going to have what the advocate is now saying. Because what we now have at this point is your input on the comments directly. You have not yet completed your response to the issues raised yesterday. We're going to ask you to complete that at the next meeting, if we run out of time now. So at this point of time, let us ask Advocate Van der Merwe to come in with hers. Now, you're quite right, and let's get this clear. It is the department that deals with policy. Yes. And it is the advocate that deals with the legal translation, if you like, of policy into law. So the advocate here is dealing with legal aspects. Where the department believes that the translation of the policy into that, the crafting of it into legal aspects, is not actually what they intended, that is the point where you will add to this list here. So you've already got a list from the members, you have a difference. You're then going to be adding to this. the differences of opinion you may have with the past. Is that clear now to everyone? And then I do think members of the team, where are the members? I see one is just kicked out. I don't mind because it's very, very stuffy. But everyone here needs to be on the same page when you come back with them. If for whatever the reason, this is going to mean that certain issues you won't respond to today, but at another time, that's what's going to happen. Do we agree? Because you should come through seamlessly as a team. Your own goals forward, you know, that kind of thing. Just seamlessly, all right. Now, so we have not finished with this at all. We're coming back to it. I hope that's very clear. Okay? So, I hope you don't mind, Dr. Nomyani Makabani, that we just now entertain the advocate's presentation for the next couple of hours.
I don't mind, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members is to keep both open. What you heard yesterday and today continues. That is this particular one here from the DCR. And what you're now going to hear, because they are dealing with the same comments. Is that not correct? Everyone on the same page here? I hope so.
Thank you, Chair. I see on the screen it cut off the heading.
Chairperson, throughout this, ever since we've been in this venue, that does not work. So I don't think we should worry about that. We've got the hard copies, and that's what we've been referring to. So I don't think there should be an issue about this one.
Okay, thank you, Chief. My presentation is on a very ugly green, starts with a very ugly green at the front.
Yes.
If we go to the first slide, it is number two, but it's the actual first slide with content. Chief, if I may be just at the outset, and I think you've already said that, but just to alert members, I cannot comment on policy. I can tell you if the policy is not what I read. And I can talk to you about constitutional issues. But even if it comes to the legal application of copyright, I might not be the necessary expert. And when I read through the submissions in isolation from the department comments, I felt very concerned. Because an argument made on one side only can be very convincing. So after having listened to the department's responses, I feel much more encouraged about the bill. But you will see from my presentation, because in fact I sent my presentation to the department and said, fair warning, I cannot answer much of these comments. you will have to respond to this. So my presentation might seem a little bit more negative than I'm feeling at the moment. And I will highlight where I think, okay, I think the department has answered. So just to point that out. And then just, I know that there was already a comment made on abbreviation. I've included the abbreviations used by Ms. Hurley in her summary of all the comments received. So the reason I've included them, and abbreviations just help me to keep my slide shorter. So I've just included so that we also have an idea of who said what, because it sometimes helps to know who was the person who said something. Okay, so just on that. So on the first, there were only a few clauses at the time. I'm only going to speak to those clauses. In the end of the presentation, there is some of the things that the department looked at that was not part of the advertised clauses that I would like to just talk to the members about, but I'll do that at the end of the presentation. So the first clause that was advertised was the definition of visual artistic work in clause 1. The submission, some say this is too broad, some say this is too narrow, as is the one with submission. Some people say this is not good enough, other people say, oh, this is way too much. And some proposals for alternative wording were made. Some people said include more examples so that we know what is included and what is excluded. Something that could be practical is from Professor Karjiker to say, instead of saying visually pleasing, rather say aesthetic, and the other one would be functional. So I think that could be a practical thing to consider. Excluding audiovisual work, I don't know, that would be probably a policy decision. As I think I understand from the department, it's not included. So I don't think we need to exclude it specifically because it is not an artistic work in any event. So I think it is by definition excluded. Some of the other things like using commercial rather than commercial live, simply because it will fit all.
Exactly what an audio visual work is. I have an idea of what I think it is, but you know when you say not within it, it would seem as if it's not something created, because there's an audio visual academy, and I'm now wondering they think themselves as creators. I'm just disconcerted.
There are a number of types of works that qualify for copyright. All of them are creative in some form or another. The one would be, and this would be in section 2 of the Act, literary work, musical work, artistic work, cinematograph film, remember that word, sound recordings, broadcast, program carrying signals, published editions, computer programs. What we are doing in our bill is cinematograph film has become a very small portion of audiovisual work. So in our bill on page 3, we are saying audiovisual work means the embodiment of moving images, whether or not accompanied by sounds or representations thereof, from which can be perceived, reproduced, or communicated to a device, and it includes the cinematograph film. So it's actually just a film. You know, if you want to bring it down to it, it's just a movie. So something that runs, and you can see moving images on it. So why I'm saying that it would automatically be excluded is that when you say your retail rosa right applies to visual artistic work, it means by implication that it does not apply to literary work, musical work, artistic work, cinematograph film stuff. So it's automatically excluded because you are saying that it applies to one type of work. So that is what I'm saying. I think it is automatically excluded. Another thing which would be to look at what type of copy qualifies, but I think this would rather fit in the actual clause than in the definition. It is quite substantive. Then in the state of commercial, what we see is that the department is actually proposing that the word commercial totally be removed, but I think we can look at this as aesthetic functional as well. Then there's also wording proposed by Vance from the United Kingdom. So all that I'm saying here is there are proposals to improve this definition. So we can look at these and perhaps come up with something that still gives effect to the intent on the artistic retail right, but just talks more and gives more detail. On the next clauses 5, 7, and 9, I put them together because they deal with the same kind of thing. What we have here is about the minimum content for a royalty percentage agreement. Now, all that was advertised was the minimum content issue because the rest was already provided in the bill as advertised originally, the bill is introduced. So, what the concerns were, so we need to be very clear, what we said in the bill is, we said that when you enter, when the author transfers, signs his or her copyright in a work, there must be an agreement. And this agreement must include, and if you want to look on page 7 of the bill, that is the clause 5, section 6A, subsection 4, and the others read more or less the same. Said the agreement must include the rights and obligations of the author and the assignee, the royalty percentage agreed on or ordered by the tribunal, as the case might be, the method and period within which the amount must be paid by the assignee to the author, cooling off period, and a dispute resolution mechanism. So that was the part that was advertised in respect of this minimum content. The concerns raised was first that we are undermining contractual arrangements and the fundamental principle of contractual freedom. Some comments also indicated that this might be unconstitutional because we are talking about deprivation of property. Now, first off, the setting of minimum content for a contract can never constitute deprivation. It is simply guidance on what must be in the contract. Furthermore, our subsection 4 says the agreement must include the following. So it can include other terms as well. And what we are saying here is we're not saying the rights and obligations are the following, and these rights must be there, these obligations must be there. We're just saying that in your contract, you need to say what each party's rights are and what each party's obligations are. We can, of course, look at this, reduce it a little bit more, streamline it a little bit more, but in this, in itself, it is not unconstitutional, and in itself, it can never undermine contractual arrangements. And I think because a number of the submissions also addressed other issues in the bill that weren't at the time. And I think when people were saying that it undermines contractual arrangements, I think they were simply speaking about the actual fact of the copyright owner having to pay over a part of the royalty. I think that is more the concern. But that is a policy decision that the committee has taken already after considering the first batch of submissions. So, some of the comments indicated you need more clarity. How would the tribunal determine what this royalty, what this percentage of the royalty would be? Perhaps we can look at giving guidance to the tribunal. Like I said before, would it be in respect of profit or licensed use? I think that is quite clear. It must be licensed use because we're talking about royalty, which deals with the licensed use. Another thing that was asked was how accessible formatted work would fit in with it. In other words, you're formatting the work for disabled, and remember there's exceptions applicable to that. So I think there are some questions that need to be considered, but I don't think in general that there's a big concern with the clause itself. In respect of the fact of this royalty agreement, some of the concerns were that if you look at the practicalities around this, and I actually don't want to go too deeply into this because the department has addressed the concerns, was that it doesn't take into account collective bargain agreements. In other words, you say there must be an agreement, but now there's a collective agreement that deals with the whole thing. It does not take into account multiple forms of remuneration possible. And the examples that we're giving here was instead of a person receiving a royalty, there might be a once-off payment or a sharing profit and things like that. So now you don't call it a royalty. So the copyright owner doesn't receive a royalty. The copyright owner receives a cut of the profits. So does he then have to pay the author a percentage of the cut of the profit, because strictly speaking it's not royalty, and our bill reads royalty. So I think it is maybe something just to consider to close that loophole. Then there was also a concern about performers' rights, and because there isn't a right for performers to actually have a share in a commercial exploitation of their performances, and how do you take that backwards? It is something to consider, because you can't create a right in the past that did not exist. That means retrospective application, and it would be strong retrospective application. So we need to be careful about that. Then there were unintended consequences. Could discourage investments because the person might not want to enter in this agreement. The concern about the cooling off period. Not all instances require the assignment. And I think this might be another loophole. So we want to protect the author, but the author doesn't actually assign the copyright. So the author remains copyright owner, but the work is being exploited by someone else. And how do we then, is that sufficiently provided for? So I think those are the kind of things to think about. There were all these concerns about unintended consequences. I do believe that the committee has already reached a policy decision on the fact that there must be a share of the royalties received by the copyright owner. So I don't want to go further into that. On the next slide, slide 5, again, this talks about minimum content, and there were some proposals made from a number of persons, and in fact I've spoken to a number of these already. What I'm saying here is just that it seems that words are assigned and used differently. So we have sections 6A, 7A and 8A read very similar. In fact, it's just the work name that's changed. So it might be necessary for us to consider whether each clause, each of those sections, will work for the rights that they are protecting. So for the work that they relate to. It's just something to consider. I'm not saying that it won't work. I'm just saying we need to look at that. The next slide is more the one that I want to spend some time on, slide 6. And this is about the retrospective application.
The point was, I have been focusing here, I may not have seen any hands. Were there any queries at the point? I only saw one at the time, and that was natural. That's all. Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Williams, Honourable Charlie, Honourable Gilbert.
Thank you. Going back to page 3. I agree with you that minimum contractual arrangements does not constitute deprivation. But what I do think, and the similar is applies to minimum content royalty, is advocate. I'm very apprehensive about putting that in a bill. And I tell you why, because once it's in a bill, it will apply to, audio visual, let's say, as a collective. And I actually think that how we should be looking at this is that in each of those main sort of groupings that fall under copyright, they may very well be subcategories in there. And what may be a minimum requirement for a particular industry does not necessarily is the requirement for another particular industry. So what I would like to suggest is that what we do is that we make is that we change the wording so that that those can be determined. Actually, one time I'm actually going to ask the minister to do something. Is for the minister to look at those specific industries that fall under copyright and to and to make minimum content requirements for those specific ones, so that they may in fact vary from industry to industry. Because I'm just not sure that one is going to be applicable for all of them. And that allows then an engagement between the ministry, department, and those specific sectors to work out for what is best for each one, both in terms of minimum contractual obligation and royalty agreement. I just don't know what, I'd like to know what your thoughts would be on that.
So you're asking for a specificity and not a general principle. Yeah.
Chair, what I'm worried about is that it may be a law of general application, so to speak, that would be applied across all industries that may not specifically suit those industries. And one may be advantaged and one may be disadvantaged by the sort of general application of minimum requirements. And I actually think that we need not look at them as sort of a, you know, sort of homogeneous or hegemonic sort of, you know, collective, but they are very individual in nature. And I think that those prescriptive minimum requirements could be detrimental, and I think that it would be better placed to allow a negotiation between the ministry, DTI, and those specific sectors to come up with those minimum requirements rather than us prescribe them.
Yes, I see you're referring to the principal act with a lot of sense, because of course that's what we relate to. I'm sure everyone's aware of that. All right. Let's go on. Who was next? Honourable
Williams. Thank you, Chair. Chair, I just have a problem, a serious problem with the practicalities, where it says does not take into account collective bargaining agreements. Under no circumstances will I support anything that does not take into account collective bargaining agreements. This is on page 4 of the at the top, the first bullet. I mean, how can it not take into account collective bargaining agreements? I mean, that's undermining everything, and we were ANC won't support that.
Clear
point.
Yes,
Honourable
Pichardia.
Was it Pichardia?
Yes, it is. Thank you. Thank you, Advocate Fenneman. You said that the copywriter, for example, won't get the royalty or get it cut off the profit. Now that will be fairly impossible if the copywriter's work is used over and over again. You will have no control if the work is used somewhere. Big Mac's fast food might play it over there. Nobody would know. You'll have no control. It will be impossible for you.
Right. Thank you, Honourable Kichania.
On slide 3, I refer to the concern about constitutionality. Now, whenever there are concerns about constitutionality, I look at them very carefully, as we all should, because these are things that could derail the problem. We don't want to go down that route. And the major concern is that it undermines contractual agreements and fundamental principles of contractual freedom, and as such may be unconstitutional in that case, which restricts the right to freedom of trade. Now, whether or not it is unconstitutional is open to debate and will be, I hope not, or perhaps will, be determined by a constitutional court. However, we must be cognizant of the fact that the reason why constitutional concerns are potentially raised, by these august people here who have raised it, means that notwithstanding the fact that it may actually be unconstitutional or not, is that there is a logic that creates these very serious questions. And it would be remiss of us not to look at those very serious questions, whether it's unconstitutional or not. Now, it refers to the freedom of trade and the fundamental principle of contract. Now, if you examine that, and as I said repeatedly, you can school people, and you should school people how to contract wisely and properly, and with all the possible help that they can get in the way of templates and schooling, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. for, but what part of the schooling is to say that you can actually say you pay me X percentage and then for further on assignment in terms of film and animation or whatever, you pay me Y percentage. You can even add a contract with a clause in there which says and you pay me X percentage of any future assignment. But the freedom is the issue. The person who is purchasing can say, well, that's a step too far. I am not interested. Take it somewhere else. And then that's the nature of competition. You take it to somebody else and they say, well, actually, I can take that risk because I have more market share. And that's how the economy works. Some people's minds anyway. But that's the issue. And it speaks to the fundamental principle of caveat emptor and caveat venditor. These are tried and trusted principles. And we seem to be riding roughshod over them. It concerns me.
Thank you, Honourable Pacharya. What is another hand at this point? Not that I'm aware of. I'm just looking in terms of the minimum, setting of minimum terms first. Providing a framework, is that deprivation? But let me turn over to Advocate Van der Merwe.
Thank you, Jake. If I may maybe start at the end with Honourable Kajalia's comment. The whole question about whether there should be a requirement for the contract between the author and whoever is the person that buys that copyright in the work, what that contract, the setting minimum terms for it is one thing. There's absolutely nothing unconstitutional about that. The Constitution, in fact, says that you have a right to trade, but that trade of yours may be regulated. In other words, so we can give guidance on what should be in the contract. The fact of limiting the person who obtains the copyright to limit that person's use of the copyright by saying, when you receive a royalty, you must pay a percentage to the author, that is a policy decision. So I cannot answer whether it is something that must be there or shouldn't be there. What I can advise you is that I am of the view that it is part of regulating the trade, and I do think that it would be constitutional if we do add that. As far as Honourable McPherson's proposal is, in respect of rather taking your minimum terms and conditions of the contract and having that in regulation, it might address, I'm also, not me, submissions raise the concern that we are having similar sections for different works and that they work differently. And so there is a concern raised. It is something that the department must advise the committee on whether it actually is something different. But we can, in our bill, move the minimum content to the regulation. In clause 33 of our bill, I just want to go to the page. That is on page 46 of our bill. We are, in fact, amending the regulation section of the Act. And we are inserting paragraph C, capital G, which says the minister may make regulations prescribing compulsory and standard contractual terms to be included in agreements to be entered in terms of this Act. So, in fact, we are providing for it. The only thing that we may want to change is that this is may make regulations prescribing, and I think that we want that to be a must. So that may be the only thing that I would caution there, but definitely we can move that to regulation. In respect of Honourable Williams' concern about collective bargaining agreement, Chair, I do not know whether this arrangement actually does not take into account collective bargaining agreement. If this industry does use collective bargaining agreements, and again, we'll have to look at the different works, because would there be a collective bargaining agreement for literary works? Would there be one for musical works? Would there be one, you know, all the different type of works? We'll have to take that into account. And if there might be one, then we need to take that into account in our bill. Because our bill will actually make it impossible for an author to enter into this agreement, because there isn't an agreement. There's a collective bargaining agreement. So I definitely agree that we need to take that into account if it applies to a literary work. The comment comes from Honourable Esterhazen about the fact that there's no control if your remuneration is a different type of income, not royalties. I do think that the department will have to help us there, the copyright experts from the department, because the Act only provides for royalties. Now, if someone is using a loophole in the Act, because the Act doesn't talk about other types of remuneration, to bypass the royalty situation, and especially to bypass these sections that we're putting in, then we need to close that loophole. And I agree with you, there will be no control if it is something different, because they are using a loophole that the Act actually provides for. I think those were the comments.
Please just comment on this one advocate. At the top page on slide 4, does not, as the agreement not yet, take into account multiple forms of remuneration possible. And clearly three different comments written there. What do we mean by multiple forms of remuneration? Do you mean that if three different stations are playing something, or exactly what?
In respect of that, that is exactly what I was saying about the loophole, about not taking royalties. So I'm the copyright owner. I want to bypass this new section. I don't want to pay a portion of my royalties to the author. So what I agree then with the person who's going to use the work, I authorize the radio station to play the song. I'm the copyright owner. And maybe not a good example, because that will normally be the performer. I'm an author. I've actually sold my copyright in my book to a publisher. The publisher allows another printing organization to publish it for them. And they say, don't pay me royalties on this. We won't call it royalties. Let's call it a cut of the profit that you make. Let's rather call it something different. So what these submitters actually said is that in some industries you don't look at royalties. And I think that comes back to the concern about in some work you actually don't assign copyright. It works on a different basis. So our wording of our clauses might be giving loopholes for people to get out of what we are intending. And I do think we need to be cognizant of that and make sure that we're not allowing people to do things in a different way, which then allows them not to pay this portion to the author, because that, as I understand it, is the policy intent.
The other issue, one understands that publishers, for example, each have their own unique contract and it's all fixed there, and authors are required then to sign off on that. It would appear as if there is no standard contract. Now, as I understand it, contracts in themselves, apart from minimum requirements, can be unique. You know, depends exactly what you want in. So this then, you would simply be laying down, as it were, certain minimum requirements that would have to have within whatever contract there was, and that would be it, as it were. Am I understanding you correctly,
Advocate? Yes, Jean. So what we are saying with our minimum content, in fact, our minimum content is very much what would be the essentials of a contract, because we are saying I'm transferring something to you and there will be a continuing relationship. And the essentials of that contract would be what are the runs, what are the payments. So actually that is what our minimum terms are saying, is this is what your contract must essentially have. So the parties themselves can actually determine in respect of each thing that we are saying. You must know what the rights and obligations are, because it's going to be an ongoing relationship that should be there, whether the Act says so or not. But what the rights actually are, each party can determine for themselves. So the contract between you and me and the contract between DDG and Margot can look very, very different. But
each of them will still have rights and obligations, each of them will still have a payment term, each of them will still have a dispute resolution mechanism.
Right. Yeah. So that everyone knows, I didn't do this yesterday, but I'm just going to hand over the chair as the honourable member who will take the floor after the last hour to the honourable Khadebi for a few minutes.
All right, Chairperson, does anybody have any time? I think the new time now is only one question per member. All right.
I think that because, you know, an example that's actually just come to mind is, in fact, BEE legislation, where there are minimum requirements in legislation, but that in fact there are actually sectoral sort of negotiations that take place, because, you know, there are different applications in different sectors. And I just, you know, I'm very alive to, you know, in this bill, there are so many different sectors that exist. And one cannot just use a broad brushstroke to to sort of view all of them. So that's why I just would like us to give some thought to making this part of regulation, so that there are so that the uniqueness of different industries can actually be recognized and can be catered for, and that we don't use a sort of general application of minimum standards to in fact advantage or disadvantage a particular sector.
All right, I think the question is very clear. Advocate, you want to respond?
Thank you, Jay. And as I said before, we can, the bill will allow us to put that into regulation. In the end, that will be a decision for the committee. What we currently have is, it is under each work, we set out the same minimum term, but we are, in fact, in our regulation providing for minimum standards to be set up for contracts. We can include it there. I would just advise that we make that we'll have to make a little bit of an amendment, that we remove the May in the introductory sentence, and we just Or we could even insert something different to say a separate subsection to say the minister must make these standard terms and conditions. Otherwise, it will be a may, and we might end up with the minister never making those regulations.
All right. From the explanation of the advocate, it shows that one is the policy position which must be taken. I think that when you come back next week, each party must have come with its own position. Because I think that to relegate this thing to regulation or all the data to agency, we'll be very skeptical about that. It would better be in the main act than in there, so that the minister can only specify for sure for the sector party. The minimum standards must be in the main bills. Is there any other questions, or allow the advocate to continue their work? No questions, you can talk.
Thank you, Chair. I'm now on slide 6. And this slide deals with the retrospective application of this royalty, or this portion of the royalty that's paid to the author. If I could just give members a little bit of background, let me just refresh our memory where we got this retrospective application from. This right that we are creating for authors is a brand new right. Now, if this bill is enacted without this bill saying that this clause or these clauses are applicable retrospectively to agree to assignments of copyright that were done before the act commenced, then the interpretation of the court would be that it is only applicable to the assignment of copyright in works going forward. So if we want this to be applicable to work that is currently out there, it has to be retrospective. Now, first off, there was a concern raised, constitutional concern about deprivation of property.
first off, we need to keep in mind that this deprivation is minimal. It is only forward. So if you are, it will not be, we must make it very clear, because that was one of the concerns as well. Are you saying for past usage, a person must now pay a percentage of the royalty? No, I would not advise that. I do think that we will run into serious constitutional concerns if we do that. So it will only be future cost indications. It is a law of general application. There is a fair administrative procedure. We are providing that parties must renegotiate. And is it sufficient reason? I don't even think I have to answer that. Our concern is that authors are not receiving sufficient payment. So I do agree we must indicate it for future payments only. Now, concerns that were raised, and here I must tell members, I am worried about constitutionality in this regard. The concerns that were raised were things like, but if you now come with this clause that there must be future payments made, quite often when copyright in a work is obtained, it is part of a budgeted project. So the person who purchased the copyright in the work, or the entity who purchased the copyright in the work, would have had a budget. That budget would only have provided for payment of the actual purchasing of the copyright. It did not take into account future possible payments that might be made if this thing is, or if this work is used in future. So you might have a problem there. You might have projects actually becoming insolvent because now there is an additional, by law, expense. I do think it is something that we need to consider. There are practical considerations. When we first did the retrospective clause, while I can fully understand the rationale, and definitely I'm of the view that there's sufficient reason for making it retrospective, I was, before this, and I highlighted this to the committee, I am concerned about the practical application of the retrospectivity. So the problem is, for instance, because remember, this will be at least 50 years after the life of the author. That we're talking about. This is where copyright will exist. So we might go back 70 years, 90 years, where that work is there. Now, how will we even know what work is out there to start off with, to enforce this, in other words? How will an author be traced? Unless that author is famous, that author cannot be traced. If the author has passed away in death state, it might be very difficult to trace the heirs. The other things that were mentioned were it might affect existing business arrangements. So there's already a business model. I think it's the same thing about the budget concern. So you already have your business model, you already have your cost structures, and now suddenly there's this added expense. Some of the work might have been obtained by a non-profit organization. So now we are adding an expense to an organization which already is not using the work for a profit. Another thing that we're saying, reprographic royalties are already shared 50-50. So how do you affect that right? Now, although, like I say, the fact of retrospective being deprivation of property, I'm not concerned with. I'm of the view that we can constitutionally apply this retrospectively. I'm not concerned about deprivation at all. But there is another rule that we must comply with, and that is the rule of law, which is in fact in Chapter 1 of our Constitution, which is that laws must be clear and implementable. So that is a basic principle that we must comply with. And if I consider the practical problems that people point out, unless we can find a way to deal with those practical issues, I am very concerned that we might not pass the rule of law principle. So that is something that I need to highlight to members. I feel very bad in saying this because I can see why this should be retrospective. but if we cannot practically implement it, if we do not have a clear way for this to happen, I am concerned about the rule of law. And I think that is probably something that the members would want to discuss. So I'll just pause there.
Well, I thank you, members. I think this was one of the most contentious causes we had to deal with. So I'll give to the members a chance, everyone, from Mr. Esther, up to my right.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Chair.
I just
want
to
mention that basically what you're saying is the copyright still exists, but the copyright owner cannot be found or whatever. Then we introduce straight custody for orphan work. That's what you're saying. Basically, that's shouldn't there be efforts made to contact or bring the children, whoever is, who have a say in this?
Thank you. Mr. Kachelis?
Thank you, Chair. I hear the advocate on her view on the deprivation of property, and I'm sure that we can, I'm sure that makes sense, and I can look at other opinions on it as well. Just one caveat in that, to the advocate, in that feeling bad is a policy matter. Leave that to us. Because I might feel good and bad. Secondly, question. What you mentioned that the parties must renegotiate. Can you explain that to me in detail? I'm not quite understanding it. And I just to say that I completely concur with your concern about an expense which will accrue later on, and the company may have embarked on all sorts of geographic and monetary expansion that could not that eat up resources and cannot shoulder that expense at a particular time, which will result in insolvency and defeat what everyone intends to do. So I think that I concur 100%. And the other one is, I hear you on the impracticability in terms of the rule of law, that laws must be clear and have to be implementable, and that makes utter sense to me. Thank you.
Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Advocate. I think that I don't think that the reasons you gave us to remove this clause is enough. Because the things you were saying, well, we can't find the people, we've already got that in there. What happens when you can't find the existing, you know, people? You've got this orphan works and et cetera, et cetera. So, and you said that you think it would be constitutional. So I don't think that it's not implementable. I don't think that the reasons you gave are sufficient to remove this from the clause, from the bill. Thank you.
I'm not a chairperson, I'm just thinking. Because I go back, chairperson, to why was in the first place this bill was started to be re-looked into. It was at the instance of the former president of the African National Congress. After he had consulted with many artists out there who were crying foul because they were left destitute. After sweating for many years, outside many of them. And I hear what the advocate is saying, Chairperson, but I'm asking myself, what would we have achieved if there will be no retrospective payment to those people who initiated or who caused the president to talk about the matter in a state of the nation address? I am not sure if it was 2014 or 2015 state of the nation address. So I'm asking myself, why have we waited such a long time if there will be no retrospective payment to the poor people of South Africa who have been robbed of their sweat and blood over time? I need to be convinced, Chairperson, that there's no way out where we can address this plight. because the reason why we were relooking into the bill was to address an imbalance in the plight of the poor people of South Africa. I may be expert that will come up. I think Chairperson, we, the subcommittee, I don't know, must go back to the drawing board and come up and together with the, to the department and see what how best can we at least appeal to South Africa, which is not enough.
Thank you,
Advocate, I think that this is opening Pandora's box. And I'm not sure that, that even to use the word unintended consequences can fully comprehend what this would do. I mean, the first question is how far back would you like it to go? And what determines that day? Why not last year, why not 10 years ago, why not 100 years ago? And then there's also, very real questions over, if those companies no longer exist, does the artist have rights to claim against the individuals or, to go after those that then started the business? And I think that this is one big hang-up that could cause a massive hangover for this bill. So I am not convinced that this is in the best interest of this bill. It also, the Honourable Mantash assumed that those people who would have been contracted before this bill received nothing, and that's simply not true. So I would, say that it would, and even if they, had received something, or there was a, contractual obligation in place, to now them to go and renegotiate that, I think is going to cause a number of hurdles. So if you can just answer the questions on A, timeline, and also B, with respect to companies that may no longer exist or individuals that may be deceased, how would artists have right to claim on those two aspects? Thank you.
All right, I think the chairperson is back and then she must take care of her seat. But before I come down, I also have an issue to raise, the issue of retrospectivity. This issue, what I like most about it, that it might not be unconstitutional, as I said. So on the issue of the timelines and how to do that, we have done such a thing before. We dealt with the land restitutions in a similar way. The issue is, those people who were deprived land, did all of them able to get the land? Where was the Department of Land Affairs able to trace everyone? The answer is no. That's why it had to be reopened almost twice. And now it has been reopened for the third time, because it could not do that. So it means that when we deal with this issue, it means that we might even decide. Let's start from the formation of the Union of South Africa, 1910. Because there was a formal government. It was no longer a colonial power. There was we can have some sort of a reference point. That one cannot be a transmission. Yeah. On the issue of whether these people are going to be traced back or not, also it's still not a problem. Because you can provide that the minister can have the power to call advertise. Yeah. Because for the next 5 years, there's a thorough campaign which is going to be done, that alerting the communities all over the country through the radio, the newspapers, that those people whose relatives or who are heirs to the people who had some sort of a copyright issues must come forward. So I don't think that's why I agree with my colleague, Mr. Williams, that this is not a chance match. This thing can be done. It has been done. It is still being done even up to this day. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. And it's also a very important Claudia in respect of application, I think. Now, when I'm taking you backwards, has everyone spoken on that? So I take it then we move off to which slide? Over to your response.
Thank you, Jay. Yes, I'm definitely on the spot with this one. First, let me say that the bill as it stands now, we have practical implementation problems. We will have to fix those problems in order for this clause to pass constitutional muster. Definitely. And whether we can fix that is where my concern lies. The department has also indicated that there are practical implementation problems. And what perhaps should be done is between myself and the department, we should perhaps go and identify exactly as many practical implementation problems that we can find from submissions and from our own concerns in this application. And if we can address each of those practical applications, then we could keep this. Because like I said, I'm not concerned about deprivation. We have a process, we have fair administrative, sufficient reasons, the law of general application, and it's minimal deprivation because it's going forward. The issue of orphan work, yes, we could apply that kind of principle. And in fact, we do provide that if the author cannot be found, then orphan works do apply. So we actually do apply for that. We don't have the converse, though. So we're not making provision for if the copyright owner cannot be found, which brings us to Honourable McPherson's question. What if the company no longer, the copyright owner was a legal person and no longer exists? Or if the copyright owner was a natural person who has passed away? So that we have not provided for. And that would be one of the practical concerns that we need to address. The proposal of having the minister do a call for people to come forward and then we work from there, that of course would create some capacity challenges for the department, but that is probably a very good proposal to deal with some of the concerns, because at least there we then know who are the people affected and you can trace from there. So I think there was one question about the renegotiation. If we look on page 7 of the bill, so I'm just going to look at one of the clauses because they are very similar. Page 7, subsection 5 there, which says a person who obtained the copyright in a literary or musical work prior to the commencement of this Amendment Act must, within 48 months after the commencement, negotiate a percentage of royalty as it be contemplated in subsection 1 with the author of that literary or musical work in question. Then you say subsections 2, 3 and 4 applies to that. What do subsections 2, 3 and 4 say? It says that there must be a written agreement and any subsequent assignment of that copyright would be subject to that agreement. And if they cannot agree on a percentage, then the tribunal may be approached to determine that percentage, and subsection 4 gives the minimum content of that agreement. So that is what the renegotiate refers to. One thing that we will definitely have to make clear, as I said, is that it will only be for future usage. The one thing that but maybe I shouldn't be trying to find solutions now. I think I would like to make the proposal that we come back to the committee on the practical issue. So let's go look at what the submission says and we list them. Because that is my main concern, is that I'm concerned that we can't get past the practical implementation problem. And I that is what I would think I would propose, because trying to talk to some practical problems now is going to be piecemeal. So I would definitely propose that between the department and myself, we prepare something, because the department has also indicated concerns on practicalities and with the implementation of retrospectivity. And then we unpack it from there.
To understand this retrospectivity really only kicks in once the bill is enacted and from then onwards, or were you saying once the bill kicks in, it could then go back to 1910, for example, if I had been explained here, write the application. All right, there was a further question or comment on the charges.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the Advocate on the Member for explaining this, the renegotiation issue, which I'm now clear on. Clear, but not happy about it. Because I'd like to say that what it does, in my view, is it makes it forward-looking by sleight of hand, which doesn't sit well with me. And in fact makes it retrospective, open-ended. We could go, and I'm sure it will be argued, if we go back to 1652. There you go.
So, what about maybe those registers who took the land?
We need
you know what I'm thinking of is not that so much, but as comment from someone's debate, and I don't know whose debate it was, quite frankly, but I was just in the chair at that time. Asked the question, did Van Riebeek have a passport when he came? So clearly it wasn't about land issues, it was about more passports and that kind of thing. And these are all, of course, as we know, relatively new requirements of documentation. But to come back to our own bill, I understood you to say, Honourable Kacharya, that you, yes, thank you for the explanation. You don't entirely agree, but you now understand what was meant. So it would seem as if we could move on. Mara. And I hope, you know, the DDG is not the only person in this department, and her colleague, the Dr. Nonyane Mokobani. There are many of you there in this, and I think, you know what is very helpful, DDG, is if they can all from time to time comment, because there's nothing worse than sitting for 5 hours without being able to open your mouth. It's as if you're in a complete monastery. So I think that there is a real need for all members of a team to, even if they say but one word, to just to be part of that team. And I know that's going to happen next week, am I right? Indeed. So I hope you're getting sort of practicing in front of mirrors your best friends. Right, let's move on.
Thank you, Chair. The next slide, slide 7, deals with the reciprocal application of the resale royalty rights. Some of the submissions indicated that there might be some vagueness. Who is the person who must actually pay the author? What scope is, should there be for this application of this? What about successors in title? The DCI has in fact indicated in their presentation that according to them the seller should be liable, so it seems that there is a clear answer to that, and it should only be visual artistic work. So I think that if we have the scope clear, we could clarify and maybe just add to the wording to make sure that we don't have any vagueness. I don't see anyone wanting to comment. Can I?
Yeah,
so
I take it you were speaking to slide 7. Yeah. And that's exactly where I want to stop. And the reason being, from Dalrymple, their view, which you've also noted here, is rather amend section 37 of the Principal Act. Okay, my dear, this is why I'm here, etc. But as you noted here, submitters generally support the reciprocal application. So the issue is around the criticism, if you like, or critique, is about the clause being somewhat vague. How are you proposing to address that advocate? Could you repeat that?
Can I
Thank you, Chair. Chair, if I maybe just make comment in respect of the amendment of Section 37. Even if that would make sense, because of Section 37, in fact, let me just go there in the Act itself, deals with the application, the heading is application of Act to countries to which it does not extend. In other words, outside of the borders of South Africa. And then it allows the Minister by notice in the Gazette to provide that any provision of this Act shall, in this case of a country that the Minister specifies, apply. So, and it indicates what the Minister can do. So the proposal from Dalro is that we rather than add to Section 37, because this deals with the reciprocal application of the Act, and then some consequential amendments. The one concern that I would have with that is that we are not currently amending Section 37 in our bill. I think we could get away with not having to advertise because we have presented the principle, but we'll have to ask permission from the House, which in itself might not be a problem because there aren't anything other clauses on which we will have to approach the House for permission. There's quite a number of clauses that we'll have to approach the House for. So that is one option. But correcting the vagueness, like I said, the question about who must pay the author, the DGI has indicated should be the seller, so we can simply correct the clause to clearly reflect who is the party paying. The reciprocal, the resale royalty right only applies to artistic work, and I do think that that's already clear. I don't think that there's any argument there. The other thing that could perhaps be made clear is if there's a successor in title, how does that work? I do think that the principle kind of speaks for itself, but it is perhaps something that we can just clarify and state it outright. This is what happens if it is in fact assigned. So, yeah, the Eurovisual Artist actually just indicated normally this is seller that is liable. And you have a situation where an art market professional may enter and take over the debt. I don't know if it's necessary for us to actually legislate on that, because it will ultimately be the seller's responsibility. If the seller gives that responsibility to a third party on his behalf, that would be contractual in nature and can be done. It is just that if the author would be taking someone to court, it would be the seller. So I think it is quite possible to make the clause read more clearly. The other side of it also is that although it would be good to have all the reciprocal clauses in one section, Section 37, the converse is also true. We are talking here about resale royalty right, and specifically reciprocal application of resale royalty. So you could argue that it should rather fit in this clause. So I think that the argument goes both ways. And if we can fix it in this, we already have started this, we can perhaps just continue.
It doesn't look as if other members want further clarity. I think we're all fine with that. But just in passing, we ought to note that there are a number of clauses which we will be having to take to heart. So if we change our position on this, we may also be able to take this to heart. Do we agree? Fine. Do proceed, Advocate Member Mover.
The next slide then is slide 8. And this deals with the retrospective application of the artist's resale rights. The comments that we've received here, in fact, it, to me, it did not seem that there was that much of a concern from the public. It was just what I said, it must be clear that it's future sales. That is the intention. That is how I understood the committee this to be applicable. And I think what we can simply do is to make it clear, set it out clearly so that there's no concern about that. The DGI also in their presentation indicated that it should only apply after the commencement and of the bill, but that we apply it to existing sales already, but it will only be future sales. And then there's just a drafting technicality where the reference is to Section 9, but it does not make sense. So that is just something that we'll sort out with the drafting team.
Okay. Slide 9.
Thank you, Chief. There were some concerns raised by the public that the log sheet could be cumbersome, costly, the fact that there's a need for reporting, whether you will have to still do registration, etc. And there were some proposals. The proposals included this should not just apply to Needletime, it should apply to all copyrighted work. And the department has indicated in their presentation that they will consider them extending this to all work. We will just have to be very careful in the extending of this to all work. We might run into a situation where we need to publish again because other parties would not have had an opportunity to comment on that. Then there were some specific proposals changing performing to undertaking, adding this, detracting that, doing this alternative wording. And I think that it's always valuable to look at what the public suggests in alternative wording. If we can make something more clear, that is always something to do. But I'm not really going to comment on that. Those are things I think the department must look, make sure that it aligns with the policy intent, and then we can work with those policy, those wording proposals. Gee, on this one I'm not going to say too much. This is about the failure to report, the fact that it constitutes an offence. Mostly it was supported. And again, we have the issue of some viewing it as too strong, others viewing it as not worded strongly enough, which I think actually is maybe a good indication that we are spot on. Some of the comments were that administrative fines would be more appropriate, that it should be in respect of all collecting societies. And then the discussion that the committee had this morning about the 10% minimum, the 5-year imprisonment. One thing to maybe just add here is we must keep in mind that the 5-year imprisonment is the maximum period.
Yeah.
So it means that it could be a day, could be 6 months, could be a year. And of course if you come back as a second or a third offender, you need a higher penalty. And I think the only thing that the committee could, or where the harshness could be considered, and I'm not saying that it's harsh or not, but 5-year imprisonment at the maximum can never be harsh, because it could be a day. The only thing where the comments of harshness could apply is the fact that our turnover is a minimum. So what we have different from the Companies Act and all the other acts, in fact our national credit, we also have the turnover percentage, but we have it as a maximum. So the only difference with this bill is that we've made that 5% and 10% minimum. So it must be more than that. That's the only thing where I think the harsh comment could be considered in, but that is in 100% policy decision. There was a proposal for private persons to be exceptions, and I'm saying I think this department will have to advise the committee. I don't know if there should be exceptions. Definitely a policy type of thing. It looks like I can continue, Chair.
Before you continue, the 60 there, advocate follow. I'm just looking at this on the point made by the advocate, Vandermover, on perhaps administrative fines would be more appropriate with enforcement on collecting societies. Currently, in 60, because they also have to register with yourself, are all your fines administrative in 60?
All legislation? Yes. Offences in terms of the company that are of punitive nature, in terms of imprisonment and etc. But the fines are administrative in nature.
Certain offences, such as?
Oh yes. Look, what we did in the previous companies, that we tried to decriminalise it, as you're aware, we made many of it in terms of administrative. So there's very few of them. It's mainly related to higher things like fraudulent activity within companies, yes.
So in respect of collecting societies, if you are collecting
We have changed because we currently do not fully regulate it. So that is the amendment that we want to bring.
Okay. I'm just emphasizing this point because one of the reasons for this amendment bill, when it was tabled, we were told is to address the collecting agents.
Yes.
You know, and everyone supports the fact that they should be regulated. There isn't one submission we got that doesn't think they should be regulated. It's in respect of how much, etc. Right. Okay, let's move to 11 advocates.
Thank you, Chair. On this one, in fact, I'm not going to say much.
Yeah.
The concerns were whether this, when you look at the program carrying signal, what about the work within the signal in the DTI as indicated that your broadcasters don't own the content in the signal, they just own the signal, and they are proposing some changes in the wording there.
Right. Any comments? Twelve.
Thank you, Chair. This is about the panorama rights and the incidental use. The concern raised, and I think it was already discussed by the department, is that you might disincentivize visual artists to create works for public spaces. I do think that this is a concern that the committee was made aware of, in fact, when the committee started considering this. But if you look at the converts and the implications of how many people are infringing copyright on a daily basis, it just makes sense for this clause to be included. But yes, that is a concern for the committee to consider. Many of the submissions supported this clause. Many supported the fact that it has a broad application. Some of the proposals would be a change of wording. The fact that it should rather be a work that's permanently situated, so if an artist just displays the work, for instance, if you're looking at, if you walk up St. George's Mall, you find many paintings being exhibited, so if you have that now in the background. But I think that is already covered by the fact that the wording that we have in the bill on this specific clause, it's incidental use. So in other words, if I walk up to the vendor and I take a picture of the actual painting, that can surely not be in the background or incidental. I'm clearly taking a picture of the work. So I do think that our work is our wording works because it's about background, incidental. And I think that you can differentiate between someone actually taking a picture of a work that is maybe displayed for sale. Another example would be a number of restaurants display statues or paintings with a price on them. Now you're having a party taking pictures and it's in the background. Clearly that is what this clause is providing for. So what I'm saying is the department can say whether we should change it, but the department's presentation to the committee was let us retain it as it is. They agree with the wording.
Right. I think you spent a lot of time on this particular clause yesterday and really freshened it up. And I think the emphasis now is, look, it's incidental use. It isn't the reason you want to capture the photograph, but rather the people there. Fine. Slide 13.
Thank you, Jean. This deals with the new process for commissioned work. Some of the concerns were that it might be burdensome. You might not know what acts you would require the work for. There might be uncertainty. I think the department has addressed those concerns in their presentation. If you commission, but you don't know what you're going to use the work for.
One moment, advocate. One of our members is urgently requiring to leave on to party business. and I'm concerned about our numbers for a moment because there was something we needed to take a decision on. Yes, and you were the one who even reminded me. No. On what this is, and that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So, there are certain things that come up from time to time, and one of them, you know, is that the FAPE industry falls under trade and industry. And we always do send a little mini delegation along. You know, it's not so much who's going, but I do need to make the committee aware of that. It's happening, I think, in October, if I'm not mistaken, in Bremen, Germany. So, in principle, I would like to inform committee members that we will once again be making an application to attend. Probably in this instance, I would not go myself, and the only reason I mention that they would probably not go is that I have also been informed by the speaker that the SAEU delegation is arriving more or less at that time. And the speaker can actually tell me what takes precedence, you see. And she may well indicate that it would be my chairing of the SAEU focus group. I merely mention that we'll decide, not we will per se, but the Honourable Froelich as chair of chairs, past chair of chairs, will take a decision as to how big the delegation will be. All right, so in principle, that is the decision that I would like us to move ahead with an application. We have someone to propose we move ahead on that. Honourable Muntash, yes, proposed and seconded by the Honourable Maxson. Now you can see how important it was to be discussed today. Thank you very much, Honourable Maxson. Now you may leave. Now, we do still have another member of the EA here, and we also have the ISP here, who is participating very actively today as well. So on this particular note, can we get back, and I'm sorry I interrupted you at that point.
Thank you, Jay. The next slide is on the new process for commission work. And as I said, I think the concerns have been addressed. There were some proposals made, and in fact, one of the proposals I do agree with. I understand the argument. Professor Carter indicated that if you, so the way that we word it now, we are allowing, in fact, the Act already provides for that, but we are specifically stating that when you commission, you can agree to only have certain rights in your copyright spectrum of acts assigned. Now, that then means that you, in effect, have two copyright owners. So when we talk about copyright owner in this clause, we might cause confusion. And we should rather talk about the person who commissions, so the commissioner, as opposed to copyright owner. And I do agree. I do think that we might cause some confusion. There was also a comment by Capasso that tariffs should rather be fee. I think the department can just advise us on the correct wording there. Then other proposals were that there should be more rights provided for, and there should be a period of disuse before you could actually approach the tribunal. And as far as I remember, the department said that we should perhaps look at about 7 years before you actually approach them, are able to approach the tribunal. Some other comments were from USAF, and this were 3 years. So if the committee looks at the timing, we could perhaps look at what that should be. And then, of course, the policy decision that comes in where some parties said, let's rather remain with what the Act has now. So your person who commissions becomes copyright owner. Other parties are saying, no, let's turn it upside down and rather have your author remain the owner and they can then license. And I think this is the Canadian model. But I know that the committee has discussed this already, and we've decided on this almost a hybrid between the two positions.
Yes, I am glad that we have decided to move to the word commissioner. I think that does assist us all. Is there anything else members would like to raise in this regard? No. Right. And you know what's going to be very helpful for members? Thinking in terms of as you move towards the base and take this bill to your constituents, is to be very familiar with the abbreviations of PASO, you know, who is it? It's not PCASO, but CARPASO, you know, etc. And we will have to be explaining this. So please take the, we were given a list, if you recall, with all the abbreviations, and let's take that along. So then we can move to slide 14.
Thank you, Chair. This deals with the transitional provisions for to provide for existing collecting societies. We are now going to change how it works. A number of proposals were made, and I think the DTI has addressed most of these. They've indicated that in general the wording is sufficient, but if I understood the presentation correctly, they were agreeing that you should perhaps have perpetual licenses. So, and as long as you comply, then you can retain the license. The concern there was that a user may be reluctant to enter into a long-term agreement, or when you get to the end of the license period, the collecting society might not be able to act. So in this regard, but most of these proposals deal with the policy behind this, and I think that these things would have been covered in the department proposal, and if there's need for wording to change, then we should just receive that change from them.
Just asking the committee secretary to just identify the clause in which it insists that collecting societies should all be registered. Have we got such a clause? Asking both the advocates and the DDG. You know, we know exactly what happens with Mashaliki. Well, because they're not registered, we couldn't get them arrested. See, the same thing with collecting agencies. Yes,
thank you, Chair. If we look at page 31 of the bill, clause 25 there, we deal with accreditation, 22 capital D, and subsection 1 says any person who intends to act as a representative collecting society in terms of this chapter must apply to the Commission in a prescribed manner and form for accreditation. So it is an accreditation, not a registration. I think we have registration and accreditation, and we had to remove the word registration. So we retained the accreditation.
Do we say somewhere very specifically that it is an offence to act as a collecting agency without being accredited?
Reserved to our cost of the law. Chair, I actually do not know whether that is the case. Can we look into that and come back to the committee?
We're getting a sharp
opposed
criminal. I think we've really got to be one step ahead. All right, an extra slide is one you've got the opportunity, I think.
Thank you, Chair. The next slide, slide 15, deals with reciprocity and where your collecting society will enter into an agreement with another collecting society. Now, you will see here one of the things where I said, actually, I'm not as concerned as it might seem from the slide. What we had, some submissions were saying this is a total breach of obligation, and other slides were saying this is so in compliance, this is perfect. So I indicated the department, please confirm what is right, and it seems that we are fine. So I'm saying that it might appear that this clause might either not be necessary and may complicate matters, or it simply confirms something that the department must advise. And what the department advised is that it actually creates clarity. Their intention is for agreement to be between collecting societies, and we're not talking about the agreement between countries.
No, we did get that information yesterday. You're quite right. So you must have been reassured, advocate, huh? Right. So that was 15, was it not? And now it's slide 16.
Thank you, Jean. This is about Clause 25 and the paying of royalties. There were a number of proposals made, and I think the department also addressed these mostly. That indicated that we could increase the period within which collecting societies retained the funds to 5 years. And if you can't find the recipient, they actually do have provision for it. We require collecting societies to place that into an investor, into an interest-bearing account. The one thing that I want to just point out in respect of the department's presentation, there were some proposals that the money where an artist cannot be found should form part of a fund.
Yes.
Now, we actually, the committee did consider this before. And the problem that we have is if an artist is not aware of royalties, prescription does not run. So if an artist only becomes aware in 20 years' time that there's royalties waiting at a collecting society, the artist will have 3 years from that date, 20 years in the future, to go to the collecting society and say, please pay me my royalties. So it is something that I do think the department needs to consider and come back to the committee with. Because you are going to have money being invested in an account bearing interest that just lies there, maybe for like 23 years. And the only problem is that there needs to be some guarantee, and that will probably be something from government to guarantee and say, you know, it might be that it is paid into the orphan fund, and government can put the backing to that fund and use the money for something. But we need to just be aware that the author's right might extend very, very far in the future to come and claim that money. So just keep that in mind.
Right. It is something we looked at, and there were all kinds of discussions around the fund. Does this amount to our money bill if we haven't funded, or what, you know, etc. And I think we clarified that. Am I correct, Advocate Vandenberg? Yes. So we move then from slide 16 to slide 17. Penalty.
Thank you, Chair. This is where we're dealing with penalty. And again, we had some comments that the penalties are too high, and then we had the comment that you need higher penalties, that they are not high enough. So it is difficult, but again, that might indicate that we are on track. One of the comments were that it's all good and well that you're putting penalties in play, but there must be other protection measures as well. Now, DDI has answered and said, but there are civil remedies. It is not like this is in a vacuum. There are other things in play. So I think that has been answered. There was a comment about turnover may not being the appropriate measure. DDI has indicated that it's a benchmark, so that's why we're using turnover. Something that I don't think DDI mentioned, and perhaps the committee could consider this, when you look at turnover, we are talking about the year before calculation.
Yes.
Now, if we take into account that sometimes our courts are very full, and it might take 3 years for a party to actually be sentenced, that might not be the appropriate year for turnover to be calculated. We might want to say the year, if the financial year is completed in which the offence was committed, then that financial year, and if that financial year has not yet been completed, the previous financial year. I do think it might be a valid point there. Then there was something about exemption for digital environments. And here is something that I want to point out to the committee, and I think I'm a bit worried about this. The Electronic Communications and Transactions Act also provides for certain transgressions. So in other words, on technological protection measures, the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act provides for very similar offences. Now, our bill provides for that, and we can argue that there is a difference from the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act, because that act only applies to electronic transactions. So our bill might be applicable, a broader applicability. The problem, however, is that there is currently before the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services a bill called the Cybercrime Bill. It is for Justice and Correctional Services. And that Cybercrime Bill actually brings exactly the same crimes and more as what our bill does. So we're sitting a bit of a conundrum. We cannot accept that that bill will be put into operation, that it will in fact be passed. We cannot legislate on another bill. But I would suggest that the committee perhaps just communicate. So that there's either that Justice come and talk to us about that bill, or that the committee itself maybe communicates with the Portfolio Committee on Justice, so that we're just aware of each other. It might be that we keep it in our bill, and that they can change their cybercrime bill so that they repeal our new clauses once that bill becomes operational. In other words, our bill will be for the interim, and then once theirs become enacted, it can repeal ours. So there are ways of dealing with it, but I don't think we can just leave it and you know, play ostrich with this. I do think we must address it.
Put it this way, we do need to inform them, of course, but on the other hand, we really must put it into our bill, because the other one is not in that, and therefore we can't just review. So we are obliged to deal with the matter, because no existing legislation does. But I do think we can take a decision and make sure where we can perhaps put them into. Just share with us what they're doing, what we can do, same thing, but also with the committee directly. All right, are we agreeing on that point? Right. Now, we move from there, the penalty, slide 17. Of course, I hope members haven't forgotten, we still got to finish another input. Slide 18.
Thank you, Chair. The clauses on the Copyright Tribunal in general were welcome. Some of these proposals that were made have already been addressed by the Pulp and Trade Industry. So, for instance, one of the clauses that were removed is the actual establishment of the tribunal, and I think we need to double check and make sure that we insert that back into the bill or into the Act. The deputy chairperson issue has been discussed. They don't want something like a deputy chairperson, they want in not a permanent body. The issue of the appeal and the review, the department has agreed that must come back. We cannot remove that. There was a proposal that it should rather be an adversarial procedure rather than inquisitorial. That is purely policy. Maybe just to refresh members' memory, adversarial would mean that your tribunal would be sitting in the front and would not participate in the proceeding except for a question of clarity. So the parties before you would be giving you all the facts. Inquisitorial gives the person who sits in front a much more active role.
No.
So that person could inquire and participate in and ask actual questions, cross-examine, for instance. And play an active role. So those are the differences. And like I said, that is a policy decision. What I have indicated is where clarity can be added, of course we should add clarity. We want our goal to be very, very clear, but I think the department has already answered everything in respect of the policy issues.
I think we did deal with that as well, and we chose to be inquisitorial rather than annual. But we move on then to what the DDG just indicates under policy, that it is not their desire as a department to get this repealed, but rather to implement it with haste. But the fact remains, that is an act that is on the statute book, but you can't ignore it. And therefore, provision must be made for it, as you say. So I don't think more needs to be said on the matter, but we do want you to complete your presentation at the end.
Thank you, Chair. Just on this issue, the department has made a proposal that we do define in indigenous cultural expression. The problem that we just have with this is that because that definition already exists on the statute book, even though it is not operational, we will have to make an amendment to an amendment act, which is a bit of a problem. And of course, we will also have to advertise that, because that will be now a new provision. The other option, but we will again have to advertise that, and I asked my team of drafters if they ever come across this, where an amendment act that is not yet operational, some clauses or the act as a whole is made operational through another act of parliament, and no one has any precedent on that. So although I'm not saying it's impossible, I do think that might be difficult. And I also think that we might run into problems because we'll have to advertise that. So it is just a few issues that I want to just touch on that the department has mentioned on the other comment. And in fact, it's not really a big concern. They indicate, for instance, that we rather should delete section 28Q and because of reasons given in their slide. The one that I want to just give caution on is if we add an amendment to section 10 of the Act in respect of the exclusive right into broadcast, we will have to advertise that. We are not amending that currently in our bill. We have not addressed that. So the public will have to be invited to comment on that. And then also, in respect of the giving consequential, making amendments in respect of the making available of rights, if there is a consequential amendment to a clause, to a section that is not currently in the bill, we will have to ask permission. Like I said, it's not a problem. We are going to have to ask permission anyway, but it's just to alert members to that. Thank you, Chair. That's all.
No, thank you very much. Well, as we keep on saying, there are a couple, in fact, it sounds like about five of them now, issues that we would have to go back to the House with in any event. So one more issue is not going to delay much. But before we proceed, I just wanted to recognize, I've only just seen state law advisor Advocate Gideon Guan announced, and I realize you've been here all day. Thank you very much for being here with us today. Right, let me just turn to the
members,
Honourable
Manapash. I want to make a quick that as part of the support of the work that we're doing for this field, our research section be given an opportunity to give us a helping hand. Whilst the department and the advocate will be meeting and looking into the things that you said must reflect that we don't agree on, that the research team be given an opportunity to assist us as well.
As you know, Honourable Mantosh, we do have a dedicated researcher, and that is the Quantum Adelani, and this Madalani is on study leave because she's writing exams until the end of the month, or preparing the thesis or whatever. So we certainly, this will be indicated to us, and other researchers are, we've told, extremely tied up, but we do have our dedicated researcher. We can, of course, request, if they do have the opportunity, in the absence of Ms. Madalani, can they assist us? And that request can be made, and we'll await their response. But I just point out that Ms. Madalani will be here only from the 1st of September. Were there any other comments to the advocate at this point in time? I think, advocate, what would be useful for us if you could make draw up this list of issues from a legal point of view, we will have to take back the Parliament, or we would have to publish or advertise again. You know, I think that would be useful if we could have that next week on Tuesday. And then, members, what we are going to do now, I hope everyone's still feeling very fresh, is we're going back to yourself then. And that is Dr. Nonyana Mokabani, who has got to slide three. Do you remember? Slide three. And then members, as per changed their view and also felt it would be better if we had the advocate first. But now what department is wanting to deal with, and what we think we would deal with, are responses. Their responses to the issues we raised yesterday. But I do need to remind the department that with respect to slide three and any other issue where we find that there is a challenge, there is a need for you yourself to discuss it internally with the team and then return. So, for example, the issue on slide three, you do need to return to us. Yes,
thank you, Chair, and thanks to the advocate for her presentation. Yeah, the thing is, Chair, we have engaged with the team before we got here, but things do happen, you know, like the weather and all these things. So I would like to maybe propose that, I like the proposal you made earlier in terms of picking up on the issues before maybe we come to the closes. When we did this, we were cross-referencing, working together with the presentation to say we proposed, the department can propose policy, but I think that we can still go back to look at the issues, Chair, without necessarily going into the depth of this presentation. I think slide three gave an indication that we need to go back as a team, as a rethink, because it looks like we're not necessarily on the same page. But I think the cleaning of policy issues between some of the things that advocate identified and what we've identified, we can maybe perhaps look at those because there's a need to converge. But I think overall, looking at what the advocate has prepared and what we have done, we do have there is alignment between both our presentations. So I think maybe identifying those few areas that we need to engage further on will assist. But I think for this presentation, if we can maybe park it, Chair, and come back, I would really appreciate that.
Well, I think what may help, we're not going to go down the packs of details, but I also don't want to try and being asked why we were expenditure on the task force that was ordered, because we said we would sit definitely until after 6 duty, but that doesn't mean to say we can't be constructive about issues. So I also know that the 15 in passing and perhaps almost informally I had raised with them issues around the connecting society, which was one of the major issues the minister had wanted to fix in the bill. we may also ask them to address certain issues, broadly speaking, in an overview rather than a blow-by-blow PowerPoint at this level. But what I think would be helpful is we saw this thing about clause, the first clause to be read like 9A in the bill, and we've already learned, look, there does seem to be certain issues you need to thresh out further. We can let that slide wait, you know, until next week. And then we go to slide 5. Section 9A, royalties. I think that there is sufficient agreement here in principle for you to address it, for the department to address. Slide 5. It says Section 9A, royalties regarding sound recording. Are we all on? Right. We've all got the hard copy. We were dealing with it. We all have these hard copies. You can just talk to the hard copy.
If you can allow me, Chair, to maybe speak to the slide about having to project it on the screen. Will it be the...
Okay.
All right. Yes. Slide 5, which deals with royalties regarding sound recording, what we have there is a review clause that seeks to align itself with the economic rights of a performer with the triple PEE priorities. This provision is expressly provided for performers in the copyright bill, but that does not say when we have the performance protection, maybe at the time when it will be an act, same provision won't be maybe tacitly considered in the performance protection bill. Obviously, you'll find its foot there as well, but we felt this is an opportunity that has been incorporated in this section. So the way it reads, really, is, would you allow me to read it, Jeff? Yes. It reads that. It says, in the absence of an agreement to the contrary or unless otherwise authorized by law, no person may, without payment of a royalty to the owner of the relevant copyright, then there would be, it may not make sense because I'm just reading it, you know, in a Sakadan approach. There would be a Roman figure for the essay, make the sound recording available to the public as contemplated in Section 9F. So basically, we are all really trying to align with the international legal instruments, and among others, that would be the WPPT. Okay, so that is the WIPO Performance and Phonograph Treaty.
Separate sheet that was handed out to us. We asked for that yesterday, and we now have it, and I assume that, yes, it was done by DGI. It refers specifically to Section 9A, royalties regarding sound. I think then that you could just speak to that as well. There are one or two points on here that you didn't address directly. Yes, DDG?
Chair, just to clarify, yesterday Honourable Ms. Jensen raised a comment around the minimum contract arrangement for the commissioned work.
Yes.
So we did not address this. Because we were finalising the presentation today, we wanted to get all the issues that we need to go back and look at collectively. So we did not necessarily look at that. But then the log sheet, because it's one of the proposals that we said will reword, we thought that we should include it.
No, well, that's okay. We've already got this handed out, so it's useful just to go through it with us. We are aware you haven't had the time yet to address the Honourable McPherson's request, and you will address that, yes, not now. But I'm looking at this where it says, any person performs an act contemplated in 9C, which you have here as well on the one you were reading on slide 5, or DOE must. And then you go on to specify, you see. register that act in the prescribed manner and form. You then go on to say, submit a complete, true and accurate report to the performer, copyright owner, or collecting society. Now, it is on that point that I wanted to seek clarity myself, because it makes it very clear that this true and accurate report can be submitted to any one of these as the case may be. And are you implying then in that sentence that if it is the performer who handed this over, it's only to the performer? If it's the collecting agency, to the collecting agency. Because the way I see it, the collecting agency may well be involved with the other two as well, you see, and not just on its own. I mean, it's not collecting for itself, per se. It's collecting for someone else. So I just wanted to get a better understanding of that. So would you be sending it to the performer and the collecting agency, possibly, or copyright owner and the collecting society? You would just clarify that.
Lately, I'll request my colleagues to respond.
However, if I... And then while Mr. Petty is...
Just to make sure we... No, I'm not as familiar with you as everyone else. I mean, so is that, let me see, Miss Mother Billy Lisa? Or is it...
It's Miss Pagora Mabasomobang, okay? Mabasomobang. I'll just respond broadly, and then my colleagues will also assist generally if they're still looking at it. However, the intention was, there was, I think, an issue around the logsheet,
yes,
that the problem was not really the information, but the accuracy of the information. It's one thing to say that the users must collect the information, however, it's not accurate enough to determine the royalty that needs to be paid, it still doesn't solve the problem. So the clause, the Roman figures part of the clause was just to address that, to ensure that the information is accurate so that the rest can be paid. And your question of whether it's paid to the performer, the copyright owner, or, and then it says, or their respective collecting societies. So it can be a collecting society that looks at the performer or collecting society, so it's all their respective collecting societies. However, I'll allow maybe some of my colleagues to pitch in.
Well, I'll be allowing, but you can invite. Yes, go ahead.
Sorry. The collecting chair is mainly by the collecting society. That's the main intention, and that's why this the information, the log sheet. There should be regulations that stipulate how these will be managed between the performer and the collecting society and the other role players in the
because in the work, because that's one of the things that has been a challenge. So how we will, it will manifest is that the collection society should ensure that that proper collection management takes place.
You know what I wanted to check with you, and many of us do listen to radio, I'm sure. Now, often, most of the time, the full sound, the song, or the track, or whatever is played, all right? But then you also get programs where they give you a kind of taste of something, as it were, where, you know, for 20, 30 seconds, almost a minute, you get the... And that is often in the quiz type of program, you know, do you recognize the X, Y, Z? Now, if you're going to be recording this, are you going to lay down some form, some minimum requirements and things? Have you played the entire track? Yes, no. Or only 1 minute of the track? Is that going to be part of it as well? Because I'm saying it could be used as part of a quiz program or something where just a little excerpt is given. And are they going to have, you know, be required to pay royalties as well? The second thing here that worries me, because, I mean, all of us now are very concerned about these collecting aid for societies. If the collecting society is the only one that gets this log sheet, and the singer or the musician doesn't, how do I know that it's correct? I'm not getting it. Or is that too onerous? So I would appreciate it if those, because the purpose here is to ensure that whatever you use is paid to the rightful artist. That's how I understand it. So are you able at this time to...
In principle, Chair, the regulations should ensure that the systems are put in place to ensure accuracy and that the flow between the users, like your restaurants and your malls and the collecting societies and the performers, is clarified. So these are the things, the practicalities that you're talking about are very important because you need those accurate records. And currently, that's one of the reasons why the payments are not done, because you find that the names of the performers, they are incorrect information, or those other challenges. So, yeah. So the regulations will address some of these practical issues that must be dealt with.
This is a very important thing. William?
Chairperson, I just have a question of clarity. If a radio station plays a song, surely they have to pay royalties to the record company, and surely then the record company should have a log of how many times the thing's been played on the radio and stuff like that. So there should be two logs, and surely that could be a comparison with the log that gets paid to the performer. I'm just wanting clarity on that. You know, how does the record company make money from the radio stations? They must have a log as well, and I bet you they monitor that because it's in their best interest. So that log must exist. And then the one for the performer himself, the individual.
Well, I'm just wondering if one wouldn't just get something in triplicate, as it were. These days, I know carbon copies are out the window and whatever, but I'm just saying that you could send your piece right once, or record, you know, once, and you would make several copies, which would go to several people. But let's rather, in this instance, because a company is involved, and then come back to you, DDG. Let's check with yourself, Mr.
Pinchin. Chair, just to give a clarity, remember the purpose of collecting societies is to administer and manage the rights on behalf of record labels and performers. That is their primary function. One of them is to go to a user, license, and thereafter collect. So when they license, if we plug requirements like this one in terms of Section 9A, they will include in those license agreements that you will finish the collecting society with the following information. Like, for instance, now SABC, because of technology, they are able to pull data every month to see how many songs were played, who do they belong to, and the duration of place. So technology is available to assist in terms of gathering that information. Even the retailing stores, they do have technology that gather all the information so that they are able to give it to a collecting society, so that they can link the repertoire and the people who own the repertoire, so that at the end of the day, it's linked to rent and sell.
No, that is useful, but I simply do come down to, back to the issue of the actual artists themselves. I'm surprised to learn that you mentioned earlier, I think, that SABC of its own accord at one some recent point in time took a decision to back pay, as it were, the various artists that it had played. Is that correct? Of its own accord. Now, why I'm raising this, am I correct to understand then that the record label, or I don't know if you still call it a record label, but the person who did the production of that song just didn't mind all this playing going on? They never got a cent. Or were they also only paid out recently? So in other words, the artist plus the producer of that song or recording, if I may put it that way, like you call it the record label. I do think that we need a little bit of clarity here, because I would be surprised to think that any company couldn't care less about the money they lose. They'd be the very first to institute legal proceedings. Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, I don't think that it was a back. They had a backlog of payments, so they just caught up with their backlog. So that's what it was. It wasn't like we didn't go retrospectively. They already had those people lined up. They were going to pay them anyway. They just managed to do it quickly. So that's what happened with that. So we mustn't confuse. But I do understand the question still stands: did the record companies also get the money? Okay.
And how long was this backlog? 2 years? 4 years? 6 years?
I'm not coming in on the backlog. I'm coming in on the split of your previous question. So how it works is the record label is still very relevant, Warner, Sony, etc., and the performer. And we're talking about the needle time rights in terms of Section 9A. So they're currently regulated by the same collecting society, SAMBRA. So SAMBRA gets the money for the recording, the performer gets 50%, and the record label gets 50%. So the right is at, it's also in line with the Farlam provision. So, but the split is coming equally from the same collecting society currently. So they both, they had to wait for the user, which was the broadcaster, to pay. There were court battles in between until the payment was made. So it's not like there were quite a few battles.
But you spoke now about just a two-way split. There's the label and
the performer.
You have no idea how long this backlog is. Will we have to get the SABC here to ask them? Does no one here know?
It was 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years.
The chair, it's a bit of a history. It went to court, and the regulations were promulgated in 2006. So we amended in 2002 regulations 2006, and we held the argument that it should be paid the needle time from 2006. The users then went to court as far as the Supreme Court of Appeal, and then they held that they only have to pay from date of judgment, which was 2014. So that is where we're locked in on everyone trying to sort out that when payment should actually be made. I know the CIPC has approved distribution plans for 2015, 16, 16, 17, but it should go back to when ideally regulations were promulgated. But that's therein where the dispute lies now.
Yes, I am concerned about this. Where are our advocates here? Advocate Vandermeer. So I'm always under the impression that when some legislation was enacted, signed off and promulgated, that was law. And then a court can override that say, well, it's not, we don't have, it's not effective from 2006, it's going to be effective from the judgment. Now, I'm really concerned about this, because if that is the kind of license the judiciary has, I'm very concerned. I see you a bit hesitant on responding on record. I can assure you your license won't be taken away.
No, Jim, I actually don't mind responding at all on that. Jim, a bill once signed by the President and published is, the general rule is that it is operational from the date of publication, unless in the commencement clause of the bill it says only operational on the date proclaimed by the President in the Gazette. So, first rule, if a bill is published by the President, signed and published by the President, it is operational. If the bill says there will be a commencement date published, then it will be on that publication date. What you're referring to in respect of courts, a court cannot say that. The Constitutional Court, it just cannot. There must be something in the wording that we might not fully understand, but I cannot see how a court... in fact, I remember there was something about the commencement of something, it might actually have been this issue, but there was a problem with the actual promulgation, which is something different. So there was a problem, it wasn't the right person who promulgated, there was something wrong with the notice, that could affect. So in other words, the court can pronounce on the validity of a proclamation, but it cannot pronounce, it cannot just by itself make a bill or regulations operational backwards or forwards. What it can say is that it can make an interpretation and say, well, you are saying to me that this would have been applicable to things going backwards, but your bill or regulations do not say that, and therefore it is only applicable from the date of commencement. The Constitutional Court can say that something is invalid, and they can then say from which date it is invalid.
Yes, I thought as much, because this would fly in the face of the separation of powers. So what I'm going to ask the DDG, and or perhaps the C, to please underline a copy of this court case, the judgment, right here next week. And because I can't simply rely on what I'm reading in the media, and I'll tell you why. I was once, according to some bright journalist, present in this country saying I'm upset about the furniture in my office, when in actual fact I was overseas. So I cannot simply rely on what I read. I do have to authenticate it. We all know that. So it's very, very important that we get the actual court judgment. I can't rely on the media. Yes, thank you, Mr. Petchy.
Chair, just to get a clarity on what you request from us, are you referring to the Supreme Court of Appeal judgment between SAMPRA and SABC?
Yes, what you refer to here, I think, that you know, and I may have misinterpreted, is that there was a judgment against the SABC where certain people went to contest. I don't know who the certain people were. And then a decision was handed down, a judgment was made. Now, that is what I want. Because, you know, I cannot see any judge taking on the role of the Constitutional Court. I cannot see that. It's too serious. So I would like it here, because I have to apply my mind, so do the members of the committee. All right? Because here I'm getting all kinds of variations on a theme in the media. And if I get another media, sort of article, I'll get another variation. I would like to know exactly what happened. We do know that some money was paid back, but we don't know the date of determination as to when it should, what judgment was precisely. And you may be speaking, as it were, colloquially, because you're not an advocate or a legal person, in the same way no one would frown on me if I made some statement that was not all that legal, because I'm not a lawyer, I'm a chairperson. So I think we don't want to rely on colloquialism now. We want the actual decision by the judge, you know, by the judge at that time, which led the SABC to then only pay back from 2014. Do you follow? That's what we want. Mr. Pecci?
Chair, well understood. In fact, if I recall, the court did not pronounce on which date should SAP start to pay. There were silence on that issue, but we have a judgment here with us. We'll be able to give it to your PA possibly.
No, you see, this is it. So let's just get that clear, and then we can unpack it. But then we come back to the issue again where we said, what is the division about, you know, with respect to this? And is that sufficient? I'm looking at the DTI with the DDG, you know, who's in charge of policy in this respect. Is that what we would like? Because here what I see, something. Is that not short, but six or something? And it's not even covered by the Labour Act. But look, the Romans, small Romans, we see here on page one of this log sheet. It says here, to specify the correct accompanying data regarding the author, we're talking about the sound recording. So do you mean the songwriter, the author? I don't know. I'm just clarifying this myself. The copyright owner and the performer. So I just want to get that clear. Normally when one thinks of an author, and this is just colloquialism again, one normally thinks, doesn't automatically think of a sound recording, put it that way.
An author will be, in this case, an author of the song, actually.
Oh, yeah. Technical words that apply in different fields, and let's accept that. Now, I want to be clear as to where we are and what we're going to get next week from everyone. And I know that the whip of the committee is going to assist me in this regard. I also need to speak to all members. Yesterday we discussed Thursday, tomorrow. Do you remember? And I learned that not only the VA holding, well, in fact, there may be one or two other caucuses as well. Secondly, I also have to look very constructively at the expenditure and whether, with two members left, this really would be constructive for us to move ahead on Thursday. Does everyone hear me? And I've taken a decision that it would not be constructive, purely on the attendance and the resources that Parliament uses to set up any meeting. Number two, it has also become very clear that stakeholders, that is the department, CIPSI, among others, the advocates here, do require a little bit more time to address some of the issues that have arisen. And we need to be ourselves quite realistic and reasonable about these demands on our side. So I have to take that into account as well. The third issue is concerning the committee, and that is that the chairperson of the subcommittee on copyright, I've already indicated, was away on a Labour oversight visit. And she will be here on Tuesday, you see. And there are certain areas one would have liked to hear what she had to say as well. and in fact of that subcommittee, due to for medical reasons, two other members aren't here. So it was really only the Honourable Pichalia, am I correct, Honourable Pichalia, who was present from that subcommittee. So next week, failing some sort of outbreak, we would expect everyone from that subcommittee to be present. We would also expect the DTI to call together a team, as it were, to ensure that you're all in an agreement as to what you will communicate to Parliament on the different issues, but also we would have had the opportunity to engage with Parliament's own legal drafter here for the Committee of Matters Advocate Van der Merwe. So I hope I've made myself clear, so that when we get to Tuesday, the 21st, we were looking at a situation of the consideration of the tripartite free trade agreement to start off with, and that also enables the department, instead of spending the night here Monday night, to catch 7 o'clock or 6 o'clock flight down to Cape Town, noting that chairs have to catch 5:30 flights down. So that's Tuesday. And I would also, of course, engage with the whip, I'm talking to the DDG, to ascertain if there are any other requirements in this regard. Then after the tripartite, you get here then at only, let's say, 11 o'clock. You can see consideration, deliberations on the copyright. But I was told that we would also want to address the National Credit Amendment Bill next week. Some of the issues. So we may do that first, and that is after the tripartite free trade agreement. Okay, so it would just depend on what the secretariat works out here. But then it would be copyright. I think, Honourable Kajebi, you would just remind me, does Parliament then have the sittings next week starting at 2? Could you just address that issue for me, please? I'm not sure.
Yes, Chair. That's the sittings for next week.
Because I know we can get, we are allowed to sit during some sittings, but there are certain sittings that we're not allowed to come after, and I'm not sure what the programme is. Are you aware?
No, Chair. I think what is best is that the Secretariat must have made an application to the committee's chair.
Mm-hmm. We have already made an application, but I can't assume that it's granted before the person has received it. So I have to await the decision of Prolic and the Chief Whip, etc. But the main issue for the department will be here for you. You really need to be here, whoever's going to be on the tripartite free trade agreement from 10, followed by copyright or national credit amendment. So are we all agreed on that basis? Okay. Honourable Williams?
Sorry, I'm just getting clarity. We are doing the amendment, the credit bill, yes, clause by clause, on Tuesday. You announced that. I just want a clarity that...
Well, I didn't announce that part yet. I just wanted it clear that we would be dealing with the bill. Now I come to what is called the unpacking of these statements. The first issue will be that I certainly would appeal to all the chief whips or the senior whips of all political parties that there is a need for their members who they deploy, can I put it that way, to sit in this committee to be here, because we are going to go clause by clause by clause on the National Credit Amendment Bill. And I want that very, very clear. I would not like members not to be here, and I shall be writing to all senior whips of political parties making this request to them. All right. And I think that that's very, very important. It doesn't mean to say we will finish on Tuesday on the matter, but I am saying that the intention would be to do that. But I cannot say that as I sit here. I cannot. Wednesday, we'll sit again, but that's Wednesday the 22nd. Thursday the 23rd, every caucus will be sitting, I understand. And therefore, it would only be from 2 o'clock that we would be available, and the House is sitting at that particular time. We would have applied for permission to do, you know, to do the same thing, but from my point of view, we would like to give staff the opportunity again to look and review their work before coming back to us the following week. So I hope this is clear. And I know all members have got, various serious issues such as funerals and that. People sitting in this committee have that, and others have very sick close relatives, wives, husbands, and that kind of thing. So we try to take all these issues into account. So next week on Thursday the 16th of August, which is tomorrow, this week I should say, is cancelled. Next week, Thursday, the following week, is cancelled as well, the morning session because of caucus. And I think we'll ask Mr. Hermans to please update this. I also need to indicate to everyone that the Steinhoff matter, the joint committee process, is coming before finance and trade and industry as well. And there will be clarity on that, I understand, on Thursday tomorrow from the Honourable Frohman in this regard. Having addressed all of those matters, is there anything we have not addressed, Honourable Khadebe?
I think Chair will comment on the point.
And then we must thank the members who remain right to the end. I know you have party matters or personal matters to attend to. Thank you very much for being here. For those who don't have personal transport in Cape Town, Yvonne will be able to advise you about the transport. Can I leave that matter up to her? So the meeting is adjourned until next Tuesday, and the venue for next Tuesday, the 21st, is the 119. Thank you.